You know, Chris, I'm pretty sad. My favorite sandwich shop closed today.
What? Well, now where are you going to go to put something a foot long in your mouth, Luke?
Yeah, because Luke likes dudes. Guys, I can't do this. I'm sorry.
Brian, what's wrong?
I mean, we're smack dab in the middle of Fantastic Fest. We're watching 4 to 6 movies a day and partying like crazy. Frankly, I don't know how you guys have the energy to speak.
Oh, come on, Brian. It's not that bad.
Give him his medicine.
Here, take a shot of this.
Oh, hell yeah! Let's get digital, bitches!
Beer!
Hidey-ho, everyone out there in digital land. This is, of course, your favorite podcast about Blu-rays and DVDs on oneofus.net, Digital Noise.
You know, we're much better than all those other podcasts about Blu-rays and DVDs on digital oneofus.net.
We're better than our gaming podcast about Blu-rays and DVDs. Yeah. We're better than our sports podcast about Blu-rays and DVDs.
We're about as good as it gets on oneofus.net when you want to hear reviews of Blu-rays and DVDs.
Indeed we are. Hey, this is Brian Salisbury, your host, your very weary host, because as I mentioned, we are smack dab in the middle of Fantastic Fest, and somehow still alive.
Beer.
I am joined here at the Red Keep by my cohort, Mr. Christopher Lawrence Cox.
Hello, I'm so glad to be here, assuming I'm actually here and not hallucinating.
Or added in post. And joining us, brief sojourn from his life in the world of the employed, Mr. Luke Mullen.
Man, it's so nice to be employed sometimes.
Yeah, stop bragging.
Space camp!
oh, yes. Infinite Variations. I'm so excited. That second episode has been recorded and will be coming to you as soon as this madness stops. Make it stop!
I didn't even need to comment about that. I just like saying space camp
now.
Totally. It's kind of like right when I'm with my girlfriend, right before I come, I'm like, space camp!
Oh, Jesus.
She loves it.
I think the over-under on their relationship just changed. Luke, call Vegas.
I owe you entirely for, like, saving my relationship. Thank you.
That's great.
Sometimes we just play a recording of you saying it.
I feel really weird. Like, I don't know if the next time I see Courtney, if I should say those words to her.
Those are our words now.
Yeah, it gets weird.
Those are my people's words.
Curls Luke's beard when you say that. But yes, we're here on Digital Noise, which, by the way, you can find on iTunes, just like all of our other One of Us content, if you search One of Us in the podcast section. And while you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review, because it helps us move up the ranks in the new and noteworthy section.
That would be very nice of you. We would appreciate it.
We like it.
And we promise we will not stand outside your house anymore and look at you through your windows at night if you do that.
I make no such promises, but I'm glad that somebody's making
you
that promise.
You agreed that you'd think about it.
Agree to nothing.
I just like to move up ranks.
Yeah, totally, right?
Ranks.
Ranks
up.
Ranks up.
I feel like I'm missing something?
That's how we move.
You've been hanging out with Jacob Hall too much.
I love that guy. Check out the diecast on oneofus.net. But before we go plug in anything else, why don't we crack open
the letter box?
You've got mail.
The letterbox, of course. This is where we take your questions and your letters, I suppose, from the digital world. And our first question comes from Tony Kearns. Tony asks, do you have any brand favoritism when it comes to Blu-ray players? What factors are most important to you in buying a Blu-ray player? Luke, I feel like this is a question for you.
It's Sony,
right? I'll be really honest. What?
Isn't it Sony? I've always heard Sony was like the top of the line for Blu-ray players.
I mean, I'm partial to the PS3. I guess I've been partial to the PS3 for a long time. It was, you know, for a bit at least, it was the first player on the market. Sony had their flagship standalone that wasn't out quite yet. And initially, you know, a lot of players didn't have Wi-Fi built in. That was a big thing that the PS3 had over other players. But honestly now, I mean, most most players have caught up. You can get a decent Blu-ray player with Wi-Fi built in for like $70-$80.
Yeah.
And I mean,
there's little to no difference.
Yeah. I mean, it's a digital signal. Like, if it gets there and you see it, then it's all there. Like, right. It's not like an analog signal that was, you know, subject to distortion or breakup or something like that. Like, if you see it, you're seeing it.
At this point, it seems like the main difference is how much of like a, I don't know if it's a hard drive or what they have on board, because I've noticed that some, like, if you get a cheaper Blu-ray player, it takes 10 times as long for the disc to load up and all the information to come up.
Right, yeah. Some of them have, like, a little flash memory chip to help with that. And obviously, based on the size of that chip and how fast it is, kind of determines how much data it can cache while you're loading a disc, so.
What kind of chip is that?
Flash memory.
I don't know. Chip. It just sounded like an expletive in my head.
Go ahead and knock this flash memory chip off my shoulder, Brian.
With dip.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess if you're looking for a Blu-ray player, like, you might look at, I mean, it's an aftermarket type of thing, but you know, you might want to look at a region free player. But as far as just like basic features, like, most any player you have is going to do what you need it to do as far as the Blu-ray playback is concerned.
I thought most players were region free.
No, not for Blu-ray.
No, most are region locked. But, I mean, you can buy legally region-free Blu-ray players. It's not something that you have to get
I don't actually know where the legality falls.
Oh, really?
On that.
Okay, well, then we don't have one. If anyone's asking, we definitely don't have one.
Can you buy them at a store, though? I mean, like a general store or something?
No.
You'd have to buy them online.
You have to buy it online.
Can you name, like, a specific...
Sure, yeah. I've bought all of my region-free players from a company in Illinois called 220 Electronics.
Okay.
220-electronics.com. And
I always feel like those guys are 2 hours early for everything.
It's a voltage.
Oh, okay. I thought they just didn't understand how 420 works, but...
Yeah,
okay.
No, they're always 2 hours behind.
I must tell you that Subject to Distortion is the official name of our digital noise band. Once we get that going,
Norwegian death metal.
Norwegian death metal,
okay,
Subject to Distortion.
There's not going to be a Norwegian death metal band on this site. I'm just calling it now.
Okay, well,
like,
that's what he
You
thinks.
Know what? If we're going to do that, why don't we just record static and have a dog bark over it? That's close enough, right?
Yeah, we're getting there tonight, in fact. And yeah, no, I'm totally listening to you, and you're right. We're not going to form a... We should spell it with one of those lines through the O in Distortion.
Obviously.
Yeah, so it's really
Norwegian.
But
that means zero.
Well, in Norway, it means...
Satan.
Means badass, I think. I don't speak Norwegian, but I'm pretty sure that's what it means.
The whole umlaut of you needs to get the hell out of here.
Umlaut jokes.
That was a bit of a stretch, I am aware.
Wow. I mean, I know we're all tired, but my God.
I don't know, man.
I had a better joke for accent grav, but that doesn't really go with that Norwegian.
No, go for it, please.
You've always struck me as a cunning linguist. Next question.
Really, that's just the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, falling back on the classics.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Internet. This next question comes from Nikodim Bredlik, who may be from Norway. I'm not really sure.
Totally,
and he
butchered
says,
that.
Nikodim Bredlik. Nikodim Bredlich.
Nicotine, you can't
Nikodim,
say shit.
It's
just
right
read
there.
The man's question.
Just
man,
put him on like a woman? Patch and you won't need to smoke anymore.
There you go. Do you guys think there will ever be a follower to Blu-ray, or is this the last in the line of optical media in the next generation? And will the next generation be all stream?
No. I mean, they're going to have a big thing that's like a big crystal, and you just take green crystals and you put it into it.
Yeah.
And then, even better, Marlon Brando does commentary for every movie.
For every movie.
Every movie.
It's insane.
It's going to be awesome. I can hardly
I would definitely buy that player. I'm just going to, just to hear Marlon Brando be like, the thing about this is the end. There's a lot of dick jokes. And it's like, yes, Marlon, that's very true. I actually ran into this issue today where I was just talking on the show, I think the last show that we did, about Star Trek, the 2009 Star Trek, and how it was on Netflix, and someone corrected me and said, actually, at the moment, it's not. And that is endemic of, I think, the reason that Blu-ray, like physical media, has not had its day. It's, yeah, a lot of things are streaming, that's great, but rights issues change at the drop of a hat, and suddenly that thing that's been available for a year is just gone one day. And if that happens to be the day you want to watch it, you're going to be craving that time when you used to collect, you know, Blu-rays and DVDs. So I don't think the future necessarily is going to be all stream unless every single streaming company can figure out how to get the rights to every studio's catalog of movies, which is as impossible as it sounds. So, I would imagine they would have to develop something between now
and this mythical era of everything streaming through the airwaves.
As well, you know, the biggest thing I hear is people talking about 4X already, which is like a lot of the theaters going, what is it? It's the 4,000?
Oh, 4K.
4K resolution.
4K, sorry, yeah. 4K, not 4X. 4X just sounded cooler.
4X is like the super hardcore porn.
Exactly. Yeah. No, 4K, which the theaters are, a lot of the theaters are going to, and might be more necessary in the theaters with that big Definitely. Of a screen. But, you know, there's already talk of them building home televisions that are 4K. And honestly, am I wrong here in saying that's completely unnecessary? Like, the human eye won't even be able to tell the difference, really, on a smaller screen like that?
Almost. Yeah. You can, but it has to be... I forget. I used to know the specs by heart, but essentially the screen has to be bigger than 42 inches, and you have to sit at least 8 feet away, I think it is, to be able to, for the human eye to be able to perceive the difference between 1080p and 4K. And the thing is, especially at home and especially at that distance and a screen of that size, the difference is...
negligible.
Maybe not negligible, but small, for sure. Now, you know, we're not talking about, like, VHS to DVD or DVD to Blu-ray.
Do you think it'll make a difference with 3D releases, though, for 3D TVs and that sort of thing?
I doubt it. I mean, I don't know. I just don't see 4K really taking off too far.
And
I could be wrong.
As well, they can fit the data from a 4K movie release if it was just the movie on a Blu-ray disc as is, I would suspect.
You could, yeah. I mean, it would have to be compressed, but you could. I mean, the movies are already compressed, so.
I mean, as it is, they put out TV seasons with, like, sometimes 5 or 6 episodes on a single Blu-ray disc.
Sure, yeah.
So, I would suspect they could probably fit one 4K movie on a single Blu-ray disc.
4X could also be really great moonshine. Like, really superb, knock you on your ass, blackout drunk moonshine.
Well, I'm from Virginia. Let me call some of my relatives, and I'll try and get some of that shit up here.
Right on. Get us some of that White Lightning, which is what we were going to call the show until someone... reminded us that that sounds like the Klan's weekly podcast, so we're going to go ahead and leave that name on the table.
Probably a good idea, Grand Dragon. Let's move on.
This is the Red Keep. Anyway, I want to thank you guys for sending in your questions. Much appreciated. And now we're going to move into the reviews. And I do want to remind you that everything we review is going to have its own link in this post. And if you're thinking of purchasing anything we talk about, or anything from Amazon in general, as long as you use us to get to them, anything you buy will support the site, and we really appreciate it.
We do. It's true.
Very appreciative. I'll come to your house and give you a back massage.
Aw, that's creepy.
If you come to Austin, I will give you a hug.
Yeah. And you have to pay for me to come to your house.
Standing offer, Luke Mullen Hugs will hug free. Anyone who comes to Austin. That's good enough. Just stand there at the airport and wait.
If you buy something off of Amazon through our site.
Oh, right.
There are stipulations here. My God, man, I'm not a hug whore.
Yeah, free hugs with $100 donation.
You're damn right.
Well, speaking of hordes of people that just want to hug you, let's talk about World War Z.
Are you saying zombies want to hug you?
I suppose that's
yeah.
That's
what a zombie is, right? They just want to give you a big old hug, right? Just a massive flesh-hugging monsters.
I suppose that's... what you tell your kids if they catch you watching a zombie film. You're like, no, they're very affectionate creatures.
And they eat lots of sausage. I will apologize, by the way, for the Hounds of the Baskerville that are apparently...
Bastardville?
Yeah, the Hounds of the Bastardville that are apparently surrounding the Red Keep as we record this. I don't know what's going on, and it's very frightening.
But Brian says he doesn't know what's going on. What's going on is their neighbors are dicks.
That's part of it. I was trying to add a little bit of elegant mythos to it, but yes, the neighbors are just dicks.
Yeah, your dogs are outside, and they're just sitting there going...
what the fuck?
Why you gotta be an asshole like that?
But yeah, World War Z was a movie.
Yeah, you know, okay, so I'm sensing you guys didn't like this film.
I didn't see this film.
Oh, I liked it.
Yeah, I was, okay, alright, so I'm glad I can talk to you about
it. Yeah, totally.
This was the movie, I almost asked on my other show on Spill, I almost asked a question, fan question day on our fan questions thing, so what movie did you talk a lot of shit about and were certain were going to be bad, that ended up being pretty good. And I was going to, you know, if we had gotten to it, I would have said, well, it's World War Z.
Yeah.
Because everybody thought this was going to be fucking shit.
Really, really bad. And to be fair, the book and the movie are night and day. Like, the book is fantastic and they're completely different entities.
This is a, like, thought you had of a, a story that might appear in a sequel book to World War Z while you're reading it, more than anything actually based on World War
Z,
the book. And that's fine. It's its own thing. I mean, certainly when they're talking about the sequel already, because this made a lot of money.
Shit tons of money.
It made a shit ton of money. Let's see if I get this down. It was $190 million. It made $536,835 million.
That's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous.
That's crazy money.
So of course they're already talking about a sequel, and they're like, well, there's no end of stuff we can draw from the book, and they're right.
Because we literally picked like almost three sentences and ran with it.
But this film stars Brad Pitt as Jerry Lane, a former United Nations investigator who's, you know, happy, he's retired, he's living with his wife and kids.
Also, I just want to say, that sounds like the coolest fucking job ever. I don't know what UN investigators normally do. Like, they kind of allude to him having been in a lot of war-torn areas.
Yeah.
Which, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that I want to, like, jump on a plane and go to Sudan and witness horrific things, but I'm just saying, like, that sounds like kind of an awesome job to have.
It does indeed not sound that bad. Plus, you know, I mean, you're Brad Pitt, too, at the same time, so you got that going.
Right, yeah.
That's not
with,
so bad.
With the crazy hair, too.
Yeah, with your loving wife who may or may not be dying. It's unclear now, according to the internet.
Angelina Jolie is dying?
You haven't heard the rumor all this week has been that she has 3 months to live, but then they're like, oh, wait, that's just gossip, and nobody seems to know what that
is. Who's been running this story?
TMZ, probably.
Oh, see, I don't watch that because my eyes are attached to my brain.
hey, what are I going to do? My girlfriend told me. Yeah. But he and his wife and his two daughters, they're happy, everything's normal, when suddenly the city in Philadelphia is attacked by hordes of zombies. Now, these are not the Living Dead zombies. These are the
disease. These are 28 days later.
These are 28 days later zombies, okay? They're like, even so, 28 days later zombies are Dawn of the Dead zombies by comparison.
I was going to say, I heard these were more like 28 seconds later zombies, where it's just like, no, zombie.
They're very fast.
Apparently, the entire country of Kenya was infected, and they just, you know, everybody's just beating feet. Zombies can run like a motherfucker.
The trailers made it look like it wasn't so much a zombie horde as like a rolling wave of, you know.
Well, that's kind of an interesting point that comes up, you know, later on in the movie, is that they do kind of start realizing that they can build human ladders out of themselves.
Yeah, and not even so much realizing is that it just happens because they just throw themselves at
stuff. Yeah, like they're all running to the same point, and it's like, oh, shit.
I mean, they're more mindless than Romero zombies. They really are. They're just direction. Smell a human, go. And the thing about this is, like, it finds a way to do something slightly different with the zombie genre. And one way that may not sound as cool, like a lot of zombie films, of course, focus on gore a lot. This really doesn't.
No, at not all. At all.
It's not the point of this thing is to be a gore film at all. I mean, there's certainly there's violence, no question, and there's a certain amount of blood and you know, nasty looking zombies, but no, it is not a gore movie. Focuses on it more like, it's more like The Hot Zone or something like that. Like that sort of, or Outbreak with zombies.
Right, right.
Whereas these guys are like dealing with this scientifically the entire time. Like, you know, Brad Pitt gets called up because he was this government badass. Like, okay, we're going to take your family and everything. We're going to bring them to the safe ship out in the middle of the water. But by the way, you can't stay here with your family unless you agree to go out and try and find this one remaining CDC station, Center for Disease Control Station. Mm-hmm. That might have a hint of what's going on and help us out. And this, of course, family's like, but you're retired. He's like, bitch, there's a zombie outbreak going like, on.
I'm sorry, woman. Do you want to stay on the safe ship in the middle of nowhere?
I will give back the gold watch. Shut up.
And, you know, the first two thirds of this film are a very different film from the last third of it, which is actually the biggest change they made. There's a lot of bad mouth about this early on, and I'm not sure exactly what that last third ended up being that they filmed, because they went back and refilmed a completely different ending. I know that the original concept was something to do with Russia, and something very similar to what the first two thirds were, but they decided...
Well, those zombies sure are Russian.
They decided to take the first two thirds that were much more of that sort of like a broader view of everything that was going on, looking at it from the outside, and the last third is much more intimate and suspenseful, as Brad Pitt in a CDC location overrun with zombies has to be all stealthy and stuff and deal directly in a more traditional zombie movie sense with trying to sneak in, get the stuff they need from this place to be able to, you know, at least do something about this situation. And it does, it's a proper third act in the sense that after everything we've already seen, it's been so big, it finally pulls back and lets you get intimate with these characters. It lets you really feel like they are personally in danger. It doesn't feel like a big Hollywood movie anymore, and it shouldn't. It needs to pull back. And I think this film actually really works.
You know, it's funny you say that. First of all, I agree. I think it's a very entertaining film, but I did have this kind of weird reaction, and it's, I want to say it's like 100 minutes, something like that. It's like an hour and 40 some. So it's not a short movie, but it's not overly long.
116 minutes.
Okay, so right at 2 hours. When the credits rolled, I thought we were in the first act. Like, I thought I'd been sitting there for maybe 30 minutes.
Huh.
Like, I was really, really surprised that the credits rolled. I was like, where's the rest of the story?
There's not much fat to trim.
No, there's not. And it's just, it's really interesting that, you know, that to me, it felt like all of the, and maybe it's, you know, from having read the book and knowing, you know, a bigger story and them trying to tell a smaller portion of it, but it just felt like, you know, the first act to a much longer story.
Well, which seems appropriate considering that they do want to go and do stories inside this world, but...
But yeah, it blew by for me. And that's neither good nor bad, necessarily. It was just kind of an odd feeling to have. Like, I really didn't think I'd been there for more than 30 minutes.
Yeah, a lot of people were coming out of the theater saying that, just saying like, wow, how long was that? Couldn't have been very long. You're like, wow, right, it's almost 2 hours. Really? It's a sign that it was actually a pretty entertaining film.
It absolutely is.
And tell the truth, it's not like it's a really smart film or anything like that. There's nothing that's going to make this an all-time classic.
No.
But it is an absolutely entertaining
film. It's not the mess we thought it would be, though.
No, not even close. Now, this Blu-ray actually looks terrific. This is an extended cut only on the 2D version, apparently, on the Blu-ray, that has a limited assortment of supplements, which has a look at the journey of the production, an examination on how real-world scientific truths and analysis were used to enhance the film, a four-part documentary, which is just separate featurettes, really, that take a look at the making of the film, and then, of course, your usual digital copies that I don't know why they still bother putting on these fucking things.
Well, there you have it. And if for no other reason, we should tip our hats to World War Z for introducing the Newtonian zombies. An object in motion will stay in motion no matter whether or not it has a pulse, I believe was what Sir Isaac had said. And moving on from World War Z, we're going to talk about Behind the Candelabra.
Did you get to see this one?
They did not, even though I requested it. They did not send it to me.
And weirdly, all I got was a DVD of it, too. HBO's usually very cool about
it. I feel like they're getting stingier lately.
Yeah, all of a sudden, too. Yeah. HBO was like very, like, that sort of, like, we're going to send you a Blu-ray of this special edition, even if you didn't ask for it. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, why are you just sending me a DVD? Okay, I can't bitch. We're still, people out there are like, shut the fuck up. You got a free DVD. What are you bitching about? Behind the Candelabra is the latest Steven Soderbergh film, of course, made now that he's no longer doing feature films. He said, I'm done with the theatrical movies, but he is getting more involved with television, more so than I would have expected, because his original plan was apparently just to paint and write.
He was going to go full Franco.
But he keeps saying, like, no, I love what TV's doing right now. He's getting involved with more and more stuff. And this film, which is a full-on theatrical film in Europe, they released this in theaters, but HBO just in America just released it here, and it's not surprising, because America still can't really get into this whole gay thing.
Yeah, it's weird how we're still struggling with that.
And this is the story of Liberace, who was, like, in the encyclopedia under, wow, so gay, it says Liberace. It's got a little picture of him there.
He just happened to start doing it before that was recognized as a gay stereotype. And by that, I mean everything he did.
Well, there's a fun point in this movie where, and this is Michael Douglas as Liberace, and a genius performance as Liberace. Wow, like so daring. And Matt Damon plays his young lover, Scott Thorson, who ended up suing him of rights because they got to the point they were, for all extents and purposes, married.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point where Matt Damon goes to them, like he sees him for the first time and then meets him after. It's like, all these families and Midwest people out here in Vegas, how do they not know that this is like the gayest thing that ever existed? They just don't know. And Liberace spent millions, like, manipulating the press to try and keep the fact that he was gay out of the press. He sued and won over multiple publications that claimed he was gay in print.
Yeah.
Had a whole setup with, like, various beards and stuff.
He had an easier time of it than Oscar Wilde, let's just say it that
Oscar Wilde didn't give a shit.
Well, Oscar Wilde, there's that famous story where Oscar Wilde took someone to court for defamation over calling him gay, lost the suit, And then because being gay was a crime, had to go to jail because losing the suit meant, oh, no, you are gay.
Well, he wouldn't have even gotten involved if it wasn't brought to that point where they went, you're going to go to jail for being gay if you don't fight this.
Well, there's a joke, too, in the first Austin Powers where he's sort of recapping the last, you know, decades that he's been asleep. And he just goes, I can't believe Liberace was gay. Women loved him.
Oh, Lord.
But this story is funny. That HBO, okay, HBO, when they do a biopic, unlike a Hollywood biopic always has to be about more than just the story they're doing. There always has to be a blindingly obvious undercurrent.
Are you talking about Ray when you say that?
I'm talking about all of them.
Because when you said blindingly obvious, I thought you were being blindingly obvious.
Don't even go there. But this is actually, HBO just tells the story, and this is one of those, like, look, this is what happened. And you know, for some that might be refreshing. For others, you're going to go, well, it's definitely a TV movie. Mm-hmm. It's just a very well done TV movie. Michael Douglas is amazing as Liberace. Like, I mean, the fact that he and Matt Damon as well, I don't know how they made Matt Damon look so young in this. Like, when this movie starts, he's supposed to be, like, in his early 20s, which he decidedly is not. But sure. He looks like he's 16.
Weird.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell happened there.
Did you do the Jeff Bridges thing from Tron Legacy?
Yeah, I don't, but it didn't look like it if they did. But, you know, he meets this guy, he's already gay, or bisexual, I guess. They hit it off. He is working for him / lovers. And it's actually kind of precious and cute until this point comes when Liberace's getting plastic surgery, which he did because he was very vain. And he goes to him, it's like, now it's your turn. What? Here. And he goes to the plastic surgeon, played hysterically by Rob Lowe. Literally the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Literally the funniest thing you've ever seen.
That Rob Lowe did.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you'll see it, and every second he's on screen, you will be holding your stomach laughing.
I just thought it was funny because Rob Lowe's character on Parks and Rec always says literally.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, he's obviously had way too much plastic surgery himself, so he's like all squinty, almost Asian looking. His eyes are so far pulled apart. It's like really funny.
Not sure that's what
but
you want.
Liberace pulls out a picture of himself and says, so can you make Matt Damon look like this?
Weird!
And he agrees to it.
That's just bizarre.
And this is early on in the film where you're like, and they've got makeup on him and stuff, so he literally kind of looks like a cross between Matt Damon and Liberace.
That's really strange. I'm not sure that I could have dealt with that. That's just weird.
It is very off-putting. And the fact is that Liberace is an incredibly vain man that wanted to believe that he was just a great guy, period, to everybody. But he's, you know, the very definition of that celebrity. He wants to believe he's a great guy. He wants to believe he's great and everybody likes him. But the truth is, he's all ego. Probably less an asshole than some, but still, this is a story of this relationship that starts out all sweet, turns kind of really weird, and eventually extremely ugly. And it does end on kind of a nice note. As everyone knows, Liberace died of AIDS eventually, and it brings it around to the point where it doesn't even have a sense of bitterness about it. Overall, this is actually a very good, very fun to watch movie, more than not. You've also got Dan Aykroyd as Liberace's agent. Like I said, Rob Lowe is so funny in this film. Scott Bakula plays a really good mutual friend of theirs that initially introduces them. Debbie Reynolds plays, I believe it's his mom, Liberace's mom. Paul Reiser has a small role in here. David Keschner has a small role in here. Really not one of the best HBO biopics. I would still say Game Changer is one of the best ones I've ever seen on there.
Yeah, it was really good.
But still, really interesting. I mean, I didn't know shit about Liberace other than what everybody knows. He puts a candelabra on his thing. He's the gayest looking guy that ever
He played a villain on the Batman show in the 60s called The Tinkler.
Did he really?
Yes, he did.
I didn't even
know. He was an evil piano player called The Tinkler.
But, you know, I mean, this is still very much worth your time. Very worth watching. I mean, come on. It's Michael Douglas and Matt Damon playing ridiculously gay guys on screen. That alone, come on, you know that raises your curiosity.
Well, I mean, the fact that Steven Soderbergh made it, I mean, I'm going to see it. And here's another interesting fact about Liberace and speaking to living in a different time. The song Mr. Sandman by the Cordettes, where a group of female singers are asking this mythical being to create the perfect man for them and deliver that man to them in their dreams. There's a lyric that says, and lots of wavy hair like Liberace. Meaning at some point in time, in 1954, Liberace was not only not thought of as being gay, but a paradigm of manhood, at least in some respects.
He was considered to be sexy. This makes it clear as well. He fought long and hard, if you'll excuse the phrasing, to continue to promote himself as a heterosexual guy. What are you going to do? People were a lot more naive back then.
Living a lie. Some of us are living a lie, aren't we, Chris?
Are you?
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just saying. This is a friend
Luke,
zone.
He's
it's very
come
comfortable.
Out right here and now. Is this appropriate, Brian?
This is very, Chris, we're all friends here. You can feel comfortable to say whatever's on your little gay mind.
Okay, I just want you to know that I have no problem with you being gay, Brian. I want you to know
this
that.
Is not going
to
be a thing. We cannot make this a thing.
I think it's great that you're finally comfortable with who you are.
Anyway,
see,
moving
on. Trying to turn that on me, and it didn't work, did it?
Well, that's because most people know already.
I'll fuck you right now to prove how heterosexual I am.
Oh, my God.
It's like prison straight. So we're going to move on to The Bling Ring, the latest film from Sofia Coppola.
Yeah. Hey, that movie sucks.
Sucks balls. I want to set this movie on fire.
Agreed.
I didn't hate it that much, but it's not good.
I didn't want to set it on fire, but no, it's not good. And this is one of those, usually, and more often than not, my girlfriend and I, when we go see these movies, that's right, I have a girlfriend, Brian.
You mentioned several times.
Like, we agree more than we don't on movies, but this is one of those ones that we almost got in a fight.
Yes.
She loved it. And I was like, I'm sorry.
There's nothing there, man. This movie lays there like a wet noodle.
Like, you, if you put this movie in our garden, our plants would grow like crazy and such shit.
So, if you guys aren't familiar, The Bling Ring is a movie that's based on a Vanity Fair article.
Called The Suspect Wore Louboutins.
Oh, right, yes.
That's the name of the article.
Louboutins.
Yeah.
Louboutins.
Louboutins.
Who's a designer, Christian Louboutin.
Oh, who's
makes very expensive shoes.
I didn't know that.
This, but not in Luke's eyes, hence his anger.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Who's gay in the room?
Oh, my God. All right, fine. I guess Luke's gay. That's fine. Chris has a girlfriend, and Brian convinced some woman to marry him, so Luke has to be gay.
I thought you were just his beard.
Yeah, well,
so
to speak.
So
anyway,
yeah.
Essentially a bunch of little preppy twerp kids in L.A. all got together and started robbing celebrities' homes is the basic point of the Vanity Fair article slash the film. I'll be really honest, like, if you've read the article, basically the film is like someone reading you the article.
Yeah.
Like, exact lines are taken directly from the article. There's no, you know, the article doesn't really have a whole lot of bias to it. It's just kind of presenting the case, and the film does the exact same thing. Like,
it's literally,
Sofia
the article's
Coppola
literally
refuses
documenting
to take a side on anything.
Because the article is documenting this group of kids in LA who got into the habit of going to celebrity homes when they knew they would Google, find out the celebrity was hosting a party in Miami or shooting a movie in New York. They would go to their LA home, break in, steal things, just kind of party in there and be douchebags, and then they would leave. And so this article is really documenting the facts of the case.
Basically, yeah. It's funny. I almost feel like the article even has a little more snark than the movie does. I mean, yeah. The movie really doesn't seem interested in coming down one way or the other on it. It's just saying, here's what happened, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's really boring.
It is.
When
it's terribly
all
boring.
Of your characters are so incredibly shallow and unlikable.
Yeah, it's like, give me something.
And then in the end, you're like, so what I'm supposed to get about that is that you're telling me that teenagers today are shallow because that they worship celebrities because of bad reality shows and stuff? Well, no fucking shit.
Yeah. This is Sofia Coppola telling you what you already know. And yeah, I could not find a single, not just that I couldn't find them likable, I couldn't find a single instance where I related to them on any level whatsoever. And it got to the point where I was like, you know, there's been this rash recently of rooting for the anti-hero. That's become a big thing right now where you have all these shows and all these movies where there's a lot of tension because even though you're watching a character doing something, I'll use Breaking Bad, something, you know, Walt has done a lot of reprehensible things, but yet we always find, well, maybe not real recently, but in the beginning, which is what's so interesting about the show. We can talk about that later. But in the beginning,
oh my God, don't spoil Breaking Bad.
We didn't want Walt to get caught ever. And the most tense moments of the show were when we thought that Walt was in danger of being rightly prosecuted for his crimes. And that's a really interesting statement about us as a society. In this, I kept hoping that not only they would get caught, but that security would bust in and shoot them all.
Yes.
I was like, fuck all of you.
I don't understand what we're supposed to be rooting for them for on any level. I mean, okay, now, being said, None of us give a shit about high-dollar clothes or shoes or purses or any of that stuff. Like, we could care less about that shit.
No.
And there's there's...
a little bit.
Don't make me go back to it.
Whatever, I like to look good.
Well, you know, I mean, there's no question there's a large contingent of Americans, Europeans, what have you, that do care about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And possibly the reason some of these people like this is because they go into it because it is a fantasy enactment. And some
sure.
It's like, oh, wouldn't this be awesome to have
it's like supermarket sweep.
Yeah. Yeah, and sort of, yeah. And you're ripping off people who are douchebags anyway.
Exactly.
Okay. I guess I can, like,
no offense to Rachel Bilson.
In concept, I can get the appeal, but in effect, I still think that that whole thing is incredibly shallow. Like, my girlfriend's, like, trying to explain it to me, like, but I love all that stuff, and it was fun watching. I was like, babe, if this same movie was about people like this, who are ripping off people for video games and rare Blu-rays and stuff, I would still go, they're a giant bunch of douchebags, and
yeah,
I'm not enjoying this at all.
At one point in the film, they are compared to Bonnie and Clyde, and I was like, stop. Like, I literally paused the movie and just went on a rant. I was like, okay, so Bonnie and Clyde, who were living in the Depression era America, had no money to their name, got sick of it, and started robbing banks. Not the same as a bunch of rich entitled kids who were bored and decided to rip off other rich entitled people.
Real quickly here, did you go on this rant to our dogs or to your wife?
To the TV, Luke.
Good.
To the, because it needs to know. It needs to know.
You need to get more sleep.
Yes, I do.
I mean, we could keep talking about this, but I don't think we're going to say anything we haven't already said. Basically, this movie sucks a lot of ass, and you should avoid it.
It has the most... I mean, it's another it's, you know, a lot of people have compared this movie to Project X, and I think that there's some grounds to that, because it is a movie about a bunch of shallow people who just try and destroy other people's lives for no reason, and then at the end, you're just like, I guess you got caught.
Project X was... Citizen Kane compared
to, to me, this felt more like Spring Breakers' less stylistic, mentally challenged cousin.
Now, I do want to say this. I thought the soundtrack to this was fantastic, and this really
decent.
Fell into my interest in music. I was like, okay. I really enjoyed the soundtrack like crazy on this. And also, the Blu-ray comes with some of the things that if I was a fan of this type of thing, I would want to see. Like, there's this 23-minute special that shows, like, the information of the real story of what happened with all these kids. You know, the sort of mini-documentary about sure. what actually happened. Yes, you'd really want to see that. As well as a thing where Paris Hilton, most shallow human being in the world, tours you through her house that they actually used in the making of this film. And shows you where the stuff was they stole, what happened, things like that. Okay, I guess that's another extra you'd want to have if you gave a fuck about this kind of garbage. I don't. Let's move on.
I will, just real quickly, I will say, my favorite part of the entire film is also my favorite part of the article, and that is that they actually did get into Paris Hilton's house because she kept her key under the mat.
Yeah.
Because Paris Hilton is a fucking moron.
I just want to point out that I just think that's hilarious.
Nothing
like, she actually did keep a key to her house under the mat in front of her door.
Nothing made me more sad here than the fact that Emma Watson's one of the leads, and I'm like, Emma, yeah. Please don't
what
be
are you
a person
doing?
Who thinks
so,
this is good.
She's so limited, too, because she's a young actress, and on top of that, they're asking her to hide her British accent, which she can do, but kind of at the expense of being able to emote or have a real performance.
True. Well, no one
I don't know. I don't know if we're going to blame Emma for
No, I'm not. I'm saying the fact that they, you know, they're giving her this movie where the character's already shallow, forcing her to hide her British accent, and then expecting her to do anything with that. I was like, well, this is not a great showpiece for Emma Watson. I'm not blaming her for it. I'm just saying.
No, I just mean, like, I feel like she could hide her British accent and emote.
I just want to say,
in a different
Emma,
film.
If you're out there and you're listening, Daniel Radcliffe, and getting started with doing very different types
She's
of films
right? Call
from
me.
Harry Potter, got his start of really being taken seriously by doing lots of nude scenes and stuff.
Oh, boy.
I'm just going to say, this might be a good start.
So how about that next title, huh? Yeah, Arrow Season 1.
I just want to point out that at least we're talking about people that are legal.
Yeah, you hear that, Joe Blow? Anyway.
I'm just saying, she is of age.
Yeah, no, it's okay. No,
it's
no, you're right.
Distinction to make.
Yeah, it's a very important distinction to make, and now that it's been made, Arrow Season 1!
Is this really making you that uncomfortable?
No, she's Hermione Granger to me. I can't.
You can't get past her in the first couple movies.
No, like
I so can.
Don't you find Drew Barrymore hot?
I never watched Drew Barrymore's first movie for me wasn't E.T. You have to remember I was born.
It was probably Poison Ivy.
Yeah, I was like it was Poison Ivy.
I was born after E.T. came out, so
yeah, I was almost in puberty when E.T. came out.
There you go.
Yeah.
So you can fawn over Gertie all you want.
No, that's not Gertie. No. Okay. Let's talk about Arrow.
Holy God, Arrow. That got weird.
Yeah, it did.
Arrow is the latest attempt by the CW to create their own little niche of superhero
stuff. Save them.
Now, certainly, they've done pretty well with this. Smallville, like it or not, I was never a fan, but wow, it was a massive success.
Brian Lerbs it.
I watched it when I was in college, and I really liked it. I liked it.
I have lots of friends who liked it.
I haven't seen past the sixth season, but I liked it when I watched it in college.
Lerbs.
I could never really get into it, but and it has a lot of the things a lot of the CW shows do. But
Tom Welling?
I think he's just on that one. He is kind of dreamy.
Maybe.
To be fair, he's a little dreamy.
Tom Welling may be the
now
second.
He's gay.
He may be the second biggest disappointment in the Superman franchise. Sorry, Brandon Routh.
Oh, God.
Don't be like that
Poor
about
guy.
Brandon Routh. Come on.
Remember Brandon Routh? What a fucking disappointment that was. Anyway, you
Shut
were saying.
Shut up a burp. Is the latest CW attempt to launch a new superhero franchise. Certainly, even more so now that they've announced that it's going to have its own spinoff, and it's just now going into its second season, featuring The Flash, the speedster character.
Oh.
Arrow focuses on Green Arrow, a character without superpowers. In fact, it was very much DC originally trying to capitalize on Batman. I mean, the original...
Capitalize on their own shit?
Yeah, oh, totally. Green Arrow had an Arrow car, an Arrow cave, an Arrow copter. He had all... And he was a rich... You know, billionaire.
He had Dart the Wonder Dog.
He was the richest guy in the city he was from that was overrun from crime, and because of a traumatic experience, he decided he was going to fight crime secretly.
What's the name of his city again? Pretending to be a Star City. Star City.
Although here it's called Starling City for inexplicable reasons.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure why. but this is put out by Greg Berlanti and Mark Guggenheim, who are behind almost all of the DC live-action TV shit now, and aren't doing a real great job, if you ask me, but
hi-yo.
Nobody's asking me. This features Stephen Amell, who's actually, despite his relative youth, has been doing a lot of TV. He even strangely won an acting award for a show he was on called Regenesis, which I had never heard of before. I looked this up on Wikipedia. But he plays Oliver Queen, the billionaire playboy turned hooded vigilante, who... When the show starts, we see that he, 5 years beforehand, was in a boat accident where his father died, the girl who was the sister of his girlfriend he was fucking around on died, various other people died in the ship, he was the only survivor, washed up on an island, and part of the conceit of this first season is lots of flashbacks as we go back and see bit by bit what happened on this island that made him come back as like this incredible badass and decide to fight crime, you know, using his Arrow skills.
Yeah.
I know it sounds funny just saying it. Like, you have a bow and arrow and you're going to fight a bunch of gangsters.
I'm reminded of the Patton Oswalt joke where he's talking about Hawkeye and the Avengers. Like, what are they recruiting at sporting goods stores now? You jump rope really fast. How'd you like to be in the Avengers?
Exactly. But you know, to his credit, Stephen Amell is, this dude, like, all right, Tom Welling's got nothing on this guy. This guy, you go and you look at him, they take a shirt off at every opportunity because the CW wants to make superhero shows that appeal to women.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah. Because
the guys are half naked much more than the women are in these things. And this guy.
It's called knowing your audience, dude.
He does this thing that I thought the first time they did it, they like had him up on a platform or something, but they keep doing it and they're like, oh wow, he's really doing that. Where he does pull-ups on a thing that has various different multiple hooks higher than the other, and he'll do a pull-up and then jump up in the air.
Oh yeah.
And put it on the next rung and do it like over and over again in a single shot.
That's a Ninja Warrior, event, if I'm not mistaken.
And I was like, dude. That's, you are buff. Full points for being kind of a badass in your own way. I'm sorry, full points. I'm like, I get tired just thinking about doing something. I get tired about thinking about one pull-up.
Yeah.
With my knees on the ground.
Exactly. No, I do one pull-up and fall down for half an hour.
Pretty much.
When do you do one pull-up?
Right before I fall down for half an hour.
Yeah, fair enough. He's called me a few times, like, help, I've fallen and I can't get up. Like, oh, God.
I am the only 28-year-old.
That's why you get life alert.
I'm the only 28-year-old who has life alert.
Well, Katie Cassidy plays his Laurel Lance. Get it? Lance? Actually in the DC comics becomes the character Black Canary, but it doesn't look like she's going to here because she's just kind of a regular chick who's a newspaper reporter and she was his girlfriend before, but then he fucked around on her sister. She died because he was fucking around on her and she's a little pissed. He's constantly trying to win her back / not trying to win her back while secretly being a vigilante. Okay. It's a lot of really pretty people being very pretty together, going to fashionable places, wearing fashionable clothes, interrupted by sequences of him putting on an admittedly kind of cool looking Green Arrow costume and actually killing people.
See, that was the thing. I've seen a couple episodes of the show, and what struck me in the two episodes I saw is that he would always get to like the last bad guy and make this big declarative, like, no, you're going to jail, I won't kill you. And it's like, really? Because you just killed 15 henchmen without batting an eye, but suddenly you have scruples.
Who gives a shit about the henchmen?
But he has
big fish here.
Suddenly he has scruples about killing the
big
villain.
Big fish story. Well,
I'm like,
here.
You're littered with murder,
and
this set is.
It's stuff like that that really is the core of the problem of this show. Like, little things that just make absolutely no sense in their core set of beliefs here. I mean, that happens so often. There's a point, like, episode 6 or so, where it's like episode 8 or 9, where he tells the Huntress, who is a popular DC character, but she's introduced in this, who's a killer. It's like, no, sometimes you do have to kill, but it's only a last resort. You're like, dude, that's your opening move. I don't know what
that
you're
is resort
about.
Numero uno
it's
for
like,
you.
Yeah, it's your last resort is not to kill. I don't know what you're talking about. And there's lots of sort of like, okay, you say one thing, then you show us another problems with the show. There's lots of stuff that just doesn't make sense or is completely implausible. I mean, the fact that like he is one of the most famous people in this city, like he's on television all the time. And he doesn't wear a mask. And people are always like, just because he's got a hood on, they're like, who are you? Like, even people he sees every day.
which seems to also be taking from the Batman universe, because it's like, Robin, no one will recognize you if you hide your eyebrows.
Don't curl your hair that way. I mean, I know that this is a conceit in comic books to some extent, but this takes it a little bit too much for granted. And there's a lot of stuff it takes too much for granted. It is bad in a lot of ways, but that being said, I had trouble stopping watching it. You know,
my
those,
God,
you know,
Chris.
Those things that are kind of junk foody that you're like, you're just lying there, you're like, all right, one more episode. Cause I kind of, there's some fun stuff.
Pretty sure I can relate to that.
And I'm a big DC Comics fan. I'm a big Green Arrow fan in the comics. And you know, every time you think you're not going to watch another one, they introduce their version of a DC Comics character, like Deadshot or, God, what the hell is the name of the guy? Fuck, the guy with the half orange and black mask. Deathstroke.
Oh, Deathstroke.
Yeah, which is basically their version of Deadpool.
Okay.
But,
I can't keep this shit straight.
Yeah, I know. And it gets better as it goes along. Now, I didn't get all the way through the series, but I'm told, Martin, who's on The Original Gentleman, told me, believe it or not, the last third of this show is actually pretty fucking awesome. It's like, it takes a lot of patience to get there.
We'll believe it when we see it, Martin.
Yeah.
Which we won't because we don't believe it. It's a weird thing about it.
I'm not watching this show.
Probably will actually watch the rest of the show.
Of course you fucking will.
I'm kind of lame. It does come with a lot of extras, but the one question I had about this release, like, all right, so we're used to getting Blu-ray and DVD versions of movies.
Mm-hmm.
When did they start doing that with 24-episode TV shows?
I'm not aware of ever seeing that.
Yeah, this is the first time I've ever seen
what
that.
Now?
Where like, you have DVD and Blu-ray for a season of a TV show in
HBO
one package.
Does that.
Do they really?
Yeah, but for like...
They do.
For
you're
like,
right.
For like 10 or 12-episode shows.
True.
Oh, this is like a 23 or 24-episode series, and the box is huge.
I would
this.
Imagine so.
And I'm like, come on, guys. Really? You guys are just... I don't know. You're driving up the price or something.
A
like,
13-disc collection of one season of a show.
I'm like, this was... Because when I got it, I was like, there's no fucking way I'm going to get through this whole fucking thing. Look at the size of this. And I was like, oh, actually only 4 discs of this are the Blu-ray version of the whole show. The rest is the 6 discs of the DVD version.
Weird.
Gotcha. All right, so watch this if you're a big DC Comics fan and you can't stand to not see it. I'm told it gets a lot better, and I did see it get a little bit better for like about halfway through the season that I got, but it's pretty dumb.
All right, well, that was Arrow Season 1. Well, jump out of the shower, kids, for this next review, because we're going to talk about Bates Motel Season 1.
Now, here's a show that's better than it has any right to be, quite frankly. I did not see that coming. Wait, did you guys see this?
Okay, here's the thing. So they didn't, Universal, even though I requested this, did not send it. And I was like, well, I know there are episodes on Hulu, right? No, there are behind the scenes, like, vignettes on Hulu. I'm not going to go on a whole rant, but Hulu is
bullshit.
Hulu, yeah. It's like, pay us, you'll get some of the shows that you can watch on your streaming device, but then some of them randomly you can only watch online, and there's still going to be commercials, but only the TV shows and none of them. Like, what am I paying you for? Yeah,
they suck. And their streaming sucks, too.
Yeah. It'll stop randomly. I'm like, yeah. You know what? Fuck you, Hulu.
Yeah, I don't use Hulu at all.
So we went to iTunes and downloaded the only episode we could, which was the pilot episode. So I watched the pilot. I was not at all impressed with this pilot. And unless this gets dramatically better than its pilot, this is not a show for me.
Really, because I liked this right off the bat from what it was doing. And admittedly, all right, so like this and Hannibal are both prequel horror shows.
Mm-hmm.
A chancy thing, but movies almost never get prequel shit right. And I think generally speaking, both of these things did, but in a really different way. This is definitely not the same universe as the Psycho films, first off. For one thing, it's set in current day.
Yeah, which is weird because in the pilot, it's the first instance that you recognize that it's not set in the 50s is after the title card when he's sitting at the bus stop and suddenly like, oh, those are earbuds. Because whenever he's at home, it's the 50s. Like, or at least, again, well, I'm going by the pilot, but when he's at home, there's not a hint of new technology.
Well, that's because they actually bought... So, all right, so let me explain this by explaining the plot here. All right, so Norma Bates, played by Vera Farmiga, who's really sexy in here as Norman's mom. I never thought I would think Norman's mom was sexy, but what are you going to do?
I'm not in this really, like, emaciated skinny... Oh, you mean, like, in this show?
In this show, yes.
Oh, okay.
And Freddie Highmore plays Norman Bates. After Norman's dad, her husband, dies in a mysterious accident, that won't come back later and be important.
Wasn't that mysterious?
move to the small town, the small coastal town, and buy, with the life insurance money, this motel, originally called like Skyview or something. Seafarer Motel. And they turn it into the Bates Motel. We're going to make a new life for ourselves here. And that's why the hotel is so, like, why it looks that way. Cause that, it's an, that, not even the hotel so much as the house is an old house that a family ran for a while. It's fallen into decrepitude because even they weren't able to.
Decrepitude.
Yeah. Yes. Use it in a sentence. What is the language of origin? Anyway.
Is that not a word?
I think it is. We're just playing the spelling bee.
I think it's a word.
No, and I
but
totally,
if we're playing Scrabble, I'm calling bullshit.
I totally get that explanation, but what makes it weird for me is they showed up with their own stuff. So you'd think at some point, again, I'm only basing this on the pilot.
Some stuff.
But you'd think there would be something in
like
their car.
They have a TV in there.
It's an old
black and white TV, but still.
Okay, you'd think if they moved with all their possessions in 2013 that there would be at least one, like, laptop or, you know.
I would argue that this is nitpicking.
It is, but I'm just saying. I just thought it was weird.
So they're there, new town. They're very optimistic. Norman seems like a nice kid. We all know he's not always going to be that way, but here he seems like a nice kid. The problem is that it's clear he has serious problems. And really the conceit of this first season is trying to find out who's the craziest one, Norma or Norman, or is in fact just one crazy and the other isn't at all. They've just been the one covering up for the other's crazy. And it's interesting the way they put together this mystery as it goes along, this sort of subtext of like, who's the one who's truly fucked up in this story? And especially in the conceit of what we know eventually is going to happen. I mean, right off the bat, they get involved in a situation where somebody dies. It looks like they're involved to some degree, and in fact, they are. But it's because they had no choice. The guy broke into their house, raped Norma, and Norman knocked him out. But then she's like, not good enough, and stabs the dude to death while he's unconscious.
Because remember, kids, if you sneak out of the house at night, your mom will get raped. Well, that is the lesson to take away.
To be fair, he wasn't unconscious. He woke back up.
Well, he woke back up.
Taunted her a bit.
Yeah,
she gutted him like
a
fucking fish.
I'm not a capital punishment type guy, but he did have it coming.
The line might as well have been, I bet you won't stab me repeatedly.
Yeah. and she does, and you're like, okay, so you do have sympathy for that. There's no question you have sympathy for them in that situation. The problem is, this whole town is fucked up. It's Twin Peaks without the supernatural or the surreal. Everyone in it is, like, evil or, has some weird...
The sheriff shows up randomly in the pilot and just is like, well, you know, it's 2 a.m. You shouldn't be out here cleaning your hotel. I'm like, I can do whatever the fuck I want, asshole. Well, why don't you, get back on patrol?
As it goes along, the sheriff, played by Nestor Carbonell, a lot of people recognize from Lost,
Lost.
Mm-hmm. is... he had a relationship with the guy who died, like a very like friends since they were kids relationship, and is really pissed and wants to know what the fuck happened. The only lead he has is these people. Because yeah. His truck is left parked outside their hotel, basically. Not a really great cover-up, guys.
And also, I'll just say...
Nor do the police even mention that part.
No, they do.
In the pilot, they don't.
Oh, wait, believe
they
me.
Leave the they leave the motel, and it's just like, I fixed your toilet. Okay, bye. And it's like, okay, that was a weird thing. Okay, and that happened.
Believe me, it comes up immediately after that. But it's them dealing with the whole town kind of being against them. The only part I found really uncomfortable here, quite frankly, was that Norman, right off the bat, every hot chick in school wants to fuck him.
Yeah.
And he is, look up Freddie Highmore. Go look him up on the internet. And you tell me this guy wouldn't get his ass beat every day, first days in school.
Remember the little kid
My explanation for that was that they must think he's gay and he's going to be their gay friend.
Just want to be a buddy.
My theory was that he rolled around in stag piss before he went to school that day.
Yeah,
and then
Brian
the pheromones
automatically, like 5 minutes into this thing, Brian was like, "This is stupid," and I'm going to mock it incessantly.
Yeah, no,
I'm starting to see what the problem
it did,
might
dude,
be.
Dude, it
here.
Did not impress me to the point that I was like, "I can't take this anymore." The only way I'm going to get through it is to make jokes. So yeah,
I'm right in the middle. I watched it on my own and on my own accord, and I thought the pilot was fine.
Yeah, it was fine, but not something
but
that
it didn't. It certainly didn't blow me away.
If you had to wait another week, you may not have gone back again and dove.
I watched the pilot when it aired, and next week I was.
And
like,
I might not have either.
Care.
But it's sitting in front of me on the Blu-ray. I kept watching, and by the time I was in the third or fourth episode, I was like, you know, I actually really like this show.
See, I think it sounds like Stockholm Syndrome on your end. It's like, well, I have to watch all of it. It's here. I'm trapped here. I might as well start forming a relationship with my kidnapper.
Is it possible the fact that you pre-made your mind up about it 5 minutes into it and then just loudly made fun of it?
I don't think it's pre-making up your mind if you're watching the actual show and don't like it. I think if I'd said, this is going to be terrible, I already don't like it, that would have been... No, I didn't...
I think I made my point.
I didn't dislike it until I was watching it. That's not pre-making up your mind.
Sure it is. If you're 5 minutes in...
It's making up your mind about what you've seen.
5 minutes of it.
It was a little bit longer than 5 minutes, but yeah.
How long was it, Luke?
I don't remember.
10?
Are we really, like, you want to talk about nitpicking?
I mean, he didn't like it.
Your Honor?
The there was never a point where he was like, oh, this is, no, it was the...
I'm sorry, make a better show.
I'm just saying it doesn't sound like you gave it a chance. And I'm saying that this is really worth your time. Is it as good as Hannibal? Oh, no. Hannibal, I think, is quite frankly a masterpiece of television. I love it. It's one of the best shows on TV today. It's very artful. It has so much stuff going on underneath the surface. This is what you get is what you get. But that, and it's even to the extent of being kind of a soap opera. But it's a good soap opera. It's fun. And the way it ties in as you watch the little pieces come together that we know how they're going to play out eventually. Things like, oh, one of the girls he's dating, her dad is a taxidermist and he finds that interesting. Stuff like that. You're like, okay, this is fun watching these pieces fall into place. And honestly, Vera Farmiga and Freddie Highmore play off each other great, as does Max Thoreau, who plays Norman's half-brother, who shows up to town and immediately starts causing trouble because he's the juvenile delinquent kid who Norma would rather just go away from a previous marriage. But I did like this. I enjoyed it, in fact, quite a bit.
You should apologize. Apologize more.
The only really thing I have to complain about is there's almost no extras on this at all.
That's really weird.
Just kind of... There it is. Okay, there's the show. Go on.
It's not like this show has a rich legacy it's drawing off of that there'd be anything to talk about in the behind the scenes. Really? There's no extras whatsoever?
Well, there's some. Hughes thing, and there were such great extras on all the Lost stuff.
Yeah, well, that might have been more of a Damon Lindelof moment.
There you go.
Damon Lindelof. What if all the extras are in space and you have to... Okay, Damon, that's a great idea, but it doesn't work.
Bring it down.
Bring it down.
Lost
bring
did have
down.
Some of the greatest bonus features ever.
That's
especially
true.
Their menus were so great.
Amazing.
They still had Easter eggs, which was cool.
Yeah. Nobody does that anymore. I'm sad.
It's a shame.
It is sad. But moving on from Bates Motel, we're going to talk about Homeland Season 2. Now, I saw the first season. How does the second one compare to the first season?
Look, sorry, I'm going to say this. It is a good show. It's a show that has a really fascinating premise.
Sure.
But you even asked yourself after one season, hell, after a few episodes.
How can they keep this up?
How can you stretch out this premise?
Right.
Yeah.
And the second season of the show that features, what the fuck's his name?
Damian Lewis.
Yeah, Damian Lewis is Nicholas Brody, a retired...
The star of Dreamcatcher.
A retired U.S. Marine who, as we see right from the get-go, was captured by Al-Qaeda, tortured for years, mentally manipulated into becoming a basically a Manchurian candidate, basically, to come over here and try and kill the vice president. A thing we saw in the first season, he had the chance to, freaked out, and did not actually do it. How far can you go with that, especially when your lead character, Claire Danes, playing Carrie Matheson, knows it's him.
Yeah.
Hell, she knows it's him so much, she thinks about him all day. She fucks him because she can't stop thinking about him.
That is the definition of bringing your work home with you.
But, you know, the real, like, I guess, attraction of the show is that Claire Danes, who is a wonderful actress, no question, she's supposed to be very bipolar. And she is also one of those people. She's bipolar, she's kind of crazy, like Luther or something.
Yeah.
Except she had control over it for a long time, but this situation is driving her crazy because no one believes her that this guy in the first season is actually this double agent. The second season is smart enough to say, okay, now everybody knows that he's at least in the government, he's a double agent.
Huh.
How do we use him and turn him back on his own people?
So they kind of gave up the ghost of like dragging this out into how long will it take before everybody knows, and more of a now that everybody knows, what do we do with him?
Well, yeah, it's a double agent situation that even so isn't necessarily working because he's concerned. He's not convinced either. He's still playing both sides against the middle to some extent. And that being said, even though he himself is married to Monica Baccarin, why would you cheat on Monica Baccarin? I have no
seriously
idea. Who gets totally naked and hot in the first episode for like the first time ever, as near as I'm aware, on television.
Have to check Mr. Skin for those stats.
Yeah, I don't
is
know.
Is that still a thing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Holy shit.
I mean,
shit.
I don't know.
I mean, thought they would go away after porn was a thing. It's, on the internet.
It's a surprised. Vital part of porn. It's an important chapter. Even though with that, he still can't help himself. He's still fooling around with Claire Danes. And, you know, the plot is good. All the side characters are good. There's so many good actors. This Mandy Patinkin is in here. Man, I love that guy so much. Everything he does.
Yeah, Mandy Patinkin is great.
Oh, he's so amazing. Although, you know, he's going to die at some point because Mandy Patinkin only lasts two seasons of any show.
Yeah.
And then he's like, yeah, I'm done. But the biggest problem is Claire Danes herself and the way she chooses to play this character, which is, yeah, we get it. She's bipolar. Yeah, we get it. She has a lot of problems. But, like, she pours out tears in every episode when she's dealing with professional CIA agents. She's talking like this. You don't understand. This guy's...
She's like the Grey's Anatomy of the CIA.
And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Who would let her keep her job when she does everything
it's just,
like this?
It would just be a question of it being unsafe. It's like, you know what's really going to be bad for your health to continue being a secret agent?
She's playing the whole, I'm on the verge of a major breakdown to the point where it just turns silly because no one would let her do her job with the way she...
To where it stretches this. The definition of the word verge.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a well-written show. Damian Lewis is terrific in this. It's got great plot twists that go through the whole first season and second season. Edge of your seat. I really don't know how long they can keep this going before I just want to punch Claire Danes in the face, quite frankly, because of this. I'm like, you're overselling this like crazy. You need to pull way back.
Fair enough. Well, I will have to check out season two to watch Chris punch Claire Danes in the face. In the meantime, why don't we talk about some haunted history?
Okay, I'm a dork. I went to go see Insidious 2.
That doesn't make you a dork. That's why you think you're a dork?
No.
Okay.
I went to see Insidious 2, and I was like, man, I love ghost movies. This isn't even one of the better ones, and I love when you get that little creeping feeling in the back of your neck and your hair stands up. I don't even believe in ghosts, but I like to make myself believe that I believe in ghosts.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite ways to be scared.
Well, you know, it's funny. I would say that you have a hard-on for ghosts, but in the ghost world, it's actually called a soft and transparent. I don't know if you knew that about ghosts.
That's a thing?
I don't know.
You're being soft and transparent.
Right I might now, be. I might be.
But Haunted History is one of those silly History Channel shows where everything, all right, here's my impression of the narrator from every History Channel ghost story. The walls, they said, were bleeding. Was it a mystery? Was it the truth? What happened that day? What happened that day in that room? Go to commercial, come back. The walls were bleeding in that room. What happened? We just said that!
New information, please.
History Channel shows on DVD are the most irritating thing in the universe because they are designed for the type of TV. They're designed for flippers. They're designed for people who sit there with the remote and check back and forth in their channels, come in halfway through a show, and they can pick up immediately what's going on, because the first 5 minutes of every new segment is
what we just told
you. Reiterating everything they just said.
It's like at some point you expect them to be, and the ghost was not at red. Oh, hold on. They changed the channel.
Yeah, and I know. I knew this going into it. I knew that this was going to be the case and that this would irritate the fuck out of me. But that being said, I just came back from seeing Inside ES2. They sent it to me without me even asking for it.
And it just appeared on his doorstep.
I want to see something about ghosts. I don't care. I got to see some ghost shit. So I put this thing on. And I got to tell you, despite all the problems, despite the fact that you see the same set pieces 100 times. Oh, God help you if there's a ghost recording at some point, like a voice going like, they shot me, something like that. You will hear it 150 times like to that episode.
I want
to
see the episode where they accidentally pick up somebody at the craft service table on their show like, is there any mustard? Can I get some mustard on this plate? What does it mean? Who is the mustard-seeking ghost?
I've got a hangnail.
He was hanged, clearly, from a nail. No, that's not what he said.
What happened at the end of Lost?
No one knows.
I saw something the other day where someone was talking about it. It's like what happened? Oh, it was actually on Arrow. One of the characters was like, so what happened on the end of Lost? And he goes, oh, you know, they were all dead, I think. That was pretty funny. But this actually has some, the actual stories it's about, like the things, historical things that happen, because these are all based on like major historical drama shit, like murders and stuff that happened. They're much more interesting than the so-called ghost hauntings that are around it. This picks up on some of my favorites, like the murder castle of H.H. Holmes in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a fucking fascinating story.
It absolutely
is. And in fact, they say some shit in this, I was like, oh, bullshit. And then I started looking the stuff up online, the claims they make. I'm like, oh, wow, there's actually some real proof for this. Not the least of which is that this guy in Chicago during the World's Fair, who built literally a murder hotel that he was just killing people by, possibly they say as many as 200 people died in this fucking thing. He may have been Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
He's like one of the only people there's actually solid proof that he might have been Jack the Ripper.
You should all definitely read the book Devil in the White City. It's fascinating.
So good. But yeah, it does a lot of cool stuff in here. It goes into Penhurst Asylum, which is another one of those, like, huge asylum. Went on to, like, the early 80s till they finally closed it down, with the abuse that was going on with these patients was all based on the Nazis' eugenics. I mean, and that's just getting started, how dark the shit was that was going on in this place. It's like, there's a lot of cool stuff like that on here. You just wish it wasn't so badly done with, like, the stuff I said, the generic voice guy, the repeating themselves constantly, being so ridiculously hyperbolic, ghost stuff that's like, oh my God, there's one with these, the Getty Ghosts of Gettysburg. And the guy they got at one point is like, he is the biggest redneck you've ever seen. And he's like, yeah, we're out in the field and I felt it. That's when I felt it. You know what I mean? He's contradicting himself in his own, the middle of his own sentence about shit.
We was in the field and then later, and then at the beach in the field is when we seen the alien ghost.
I don't know. Oh, that's for that's for Ancient Aliens. I'm sorry. Long show.
Everything is aliens.
Can we do that again? I don't know. I mean, I like ghost stories. But regardless of that, there are some interesting stories here. It's just, God, I wish somebody would do a show about this type of stuff that was actually trying to be serious about it, trying to do a good show. Bring in skeptics. Go, well, they say this, but look, here's our explanation for it. That would be interesting to me. Nobody's making that show. I guess it's as good as we can get right now.
We will take it, apparently. And, oh, also a little known fact about ghost shit, as Chris referred to it. It smells like blueberry. That is a real fact from a ghost book that I totally read.
So if a werewolf has droppings, does it taste like fruit brute?
I didn't say it tastes like, I said it smelled like, and also the answer is yes. So moving on to Day of the Dead, which is the latest from Scream Factory, the shout off shoot that we love so much.
Here's my impression of every villain in this movie. You motherfuckers are gonna do what I say, or I'm gonna fuck you in the ass with the butt of my gun.
Because I'm in the military and therefore a dick.
Dude, alright, I hadn't seen this for a long time. And I remember liking it, but going, this isn't as good as the first two. And I gotta say, there's a reason why I didn't like this film that much when I first saw it.
See, it's funny. I didn't like it very much when I first saw it either, but this viewing, actually, I had developed more of an appreciation for it. And I think the exact reason is because I had so recently run through The Walking Dead. I felt like the reason that I didn't like this initially is because it does have such a dramatically different tone from Dawn of the Dead or from Night of the Living Dead. But I started to realize, like, this feels like a really, and like maybe not one of the best episodes, but it feels like a longer episode of The Walking Dead, because it does have that weird sort of like, even the people, like the last fragments of society, even those people who are living together are going to be complete and utter dickbags to each other, like to the point that it's like the human existence is totally nihilistic. And I was like, oh, okay, this actually, I can see the merit in this now. And I enjoy, obviously, the practical effects in this, which are
are stellar.
Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely stellar. Greg Nicotero, who also played a role in this film as well, working with Tom Savini, I believe, on the effects for this.
Yep, he played Johnson.
Yeah, he's a genius practical effects guy, no question about it. And there's even nice, really nice moments with some of the other characters in this film who aren't the military guys. You're like, wow, these are some cool conversations going on. There's stuff that makes you think about, like, you know, what the underlying social mechanism is that Romero was ultimately trying to talk about, like was.
And he paints it with a really heavy brush here, more so. Like, it is way overstated in this, where it's like, literally, and they state it implicitly or explicitly, it's like the scientists over here, the military over here.
But that's what I'm saying, is the quieter moments are not bad. The problem is that there's nothing gray about the villains at all. I mean, literally, this lead guy who's the head of the military here,
Rhodes.
I mean, he couldn't be overplaying it anymore if it was a young Michael Shannon in this role. I mean, he's like, I mean, right from the first time you see him, he's like practically shaking with the crazy eyes. And you're like, okay, who is seriously following this guy? Like, his number one guy.
How awesome would this movie have been if it was Michael Shannon?
The number one guy on this looks like a young version of the captain from Gilligan's Island if he was cranked up on meth.
The skipper.
Yeah, the skipper. Yeah. He's just, yeah, fuck you, bitch, I'm gonna kill you. Watch you do how? Would you come over here? I'll fuck you with my dick. Then I'll shoot you in the head. Like, seriously, who wrote this?
I did.
Yeah, I mean, I still to this day maintain it is the weakest of the three. Absolutely. There's no question about that. However, it was on this viewing when I was like, okay, it's very overstated. It's very minimal, which I don't know. There's a great story in one of the featurettes on this Blu-ray where they talk about what Romero's original vision for this film was. And it was essentially Raiders of the Lost Ark with zombies.
It was
going to basically be this globe-trotting adventure story, and it was going to take place within a world where the zombie uprising can happen. But unfortunately, the studio he made this for gave him a chunk of money to make three movies, and he spent most of it on Creepshow and Knight Riders. So when it came time to make Day of the Dead, it was like, oh, well, I only have this much money left, so let's cut a lot of shit out of the script.
Now, we'll say this. The documentary about this, the hour-and-a-half documentary called The World's End, Legacy of Day of the Dead, is by far the best documentary about any of the Dead films.
Oh, it's great.
I mean, it's fantastic. And definitely, there's so many great stories in here. One of my all-time favorite horror movie stories about, like, God, can you believe they put up with that? There's a sequence in this film where a guy literally gets pulled apart by zombies who then reach into his halves as he's still alive and start eating his guts right in front of him in a very graphic, nothing cutaway shot.
Yeah.
The problem is with the shot, which required a ton of intestines, was that the air conditioning in the storage shed that were holding these actual pig and cow intestines went off and all of them rotted. They did not have the money to replace said intestines. So these actors had to actually, with like just stankin' rotten intestines, had to put these things up in their mouths and shit. And if you watch this really closely, there's a sequence you can see people kind of turn away as they're doing it and puking. Because it was just that foul.
Wow.
Yeah. No, but this is a really, really great documentary for okay Romero zombie film.
Well, and it's funny, that story you told is almost identical to one that happened to Herschel Gordon Lewis in the movie Blood Feast, where there's a scene. If you're not familiar with Herschel Gordon Lewis, he is the godfather of the splatter film. He made a movie called Blood Feast in which, at one point, the killer cuts the tongue out of a girl's mouth, and they used a beef tongue, and the hotel fridge where they're keeping it, the power went out. So almost the exact same situation, except with a beef tongue. But yeah, I think this is, it looks really good, first of all, on Blu-ray. Sure, I mean, yeah. there's still grain, but it's that comfortable level of grain where it's like, okay, this movie isn't cleaned up to the fact where it looks false, which I appreciate. And it is loaded with special features. The documentary that Chris was talking about, they even have, this was one of the weirdest things I've ever seen on one of these Scream Factory releases. They have a promotional video for the business park that they were building in the cave where they shot this movie. It has nothing to do with the movie. No. It was just like, if you'd like to rent space in this cave, we've found that in Pennsylvania, this is really a affordable alternative to building above ground. And here's why. It's like this weird, like, corporate video. It's bizarre. It's like, is this fake? Is this a viral marketing thing?
It's weird as well. They've got the commentary originally done for the Anchor Bay release with Roger Avery, who had nothing to do with this film, but he's a huge fan. And it's just him talking about why he thinks this is great and how this started his career as a film that influenced him. It's like, okay, that's weird choice, but all right, sure. Recorded from prison. No, it was not.
Well, I mean, and of course, this is also the movie that gave us Bub the Zombie, who is one of the more indelible characters of the entire day.
Agreed. I love Bub the
Trilogy.
Zombie. Yeah.
And, this is a great release for fans of this movie. And I think if you're somebody who wants to own the entire original Dead Trilogy on Blu-ray, then why wouldn't you pick this up?
Sure.
Why would you pick up any other version of Day of the Dead than the one that Shout Factory puts out?
Like I said, it is fun. It's just the least of the original.
It does have the best final line of any character, I think, in this trilogy, which is when Rhodes is getting pulled apart and he just goes, "Choke on him! Choke on him!" So good. So good. Anyway, so that was Day of the Dead. Now we're going to talk about The Last Tycoon. Probably the last one because of all the zombies!
No, there were no zombies.
Oh, fuck you, F. Scott Fitzgerald.
You know, this isn't actually based on F. Scott Fitzgerald because I linked to the wrong page on Wikipedia. Sorry about that.
No, I was like, I'm familiar with The Last Tycoon, the novel by
Not
F. Scott.
Not based on that at all.
All right, well then what the hell is this, Chris?
Imagine if Martin Scorsese wanted to make a heroic bloodshed film with Chow Yun-Fat as a period piece.
What?
Yeah.
Okay, now
Sounds
you've got
awesome,
my attention.
Right? And it is awesome! The downside being that sometimes its influences wear a little thin. There's literally a sequence in the middle of this film where it makes sense in the plot, but it doesn't make sense as the planner. Why is the end of Casablanca in this movie? Literally. You're like, wait, this is the end of Casablanca! Like, exactly the end of Casablanca! Why is this here?
Because it's the beginning of a beautiful ripoff.
I don't know. But more than anything, this is gonna remind you of The Godfather Part 2, but with heroic bloodshed shit, which means, like, the killer or hardboiled, that sort of stuff. It's a story of Chow Yun-Fat, who was based on a real guy, who...
Chow Yun-Fat is based on a real... I thought Chow Yun-Fat was a real guy.
No, he's based... His character here is based on a real guy. Who was a major gangster triad member in, I guess it was like the 30s, who ended up becoming a huge hero for China in the war against Japan, when Japan was invading China and just killing fucking everyone who came near them.
Tends to be a popular theme in Chinese cinema.
Well, it was odd to see a film, though, where a triad member is turned into a national hero. That's a little odd.
Sure.
And this goes back and forth in time from the younger version of him to the older Chow Yun-Fat version. That's kind of bookended by a romance with a girl he loved once long ago who wanted to be an opera singer. They lost touch in each other. He becomes this huge, successful triad member, meets up with her. She's married to a guy. Like, okay, crap. So you've got that little story. He's married to another girl who's much hotter than her, for the record. But, you know, you've got that love triangle shit going on. That story gets more and more complicated as it goes on. Once Japan invades, everyone's forced to make compromises. He's basically one of the head members of the resistance dealing against them with spectacular cinematography and one fuck of a budget. I mean, they built a huge, really realistic China in the 30s, like, whole city, and they blow the living shit out of it. I mean, they just blow it to pieces.
They may have actually blown up a portion of China. We're not entirely sure.
It's hard to say. This is... It's so close to being a movie I would call a classic, but it makes some big missteps here and there that have a lot to do with the romance and the triangle, which at points it's just too treacly, it's caving in on itself by the degree it wants us to give a shit about this romantic triangle when stuff that's much more interesting is going on around them. And like I said, not the least of which is it just flat out rips off Casablanca in a kind of embarrassing fashion. But so much of this is so good. It's so beautifully shot. Chow Yun-Fat is fantastic. He's running around doing the classic thing with the double guns. Like, just, I mean, all right, when you're Chow Yun-Fat, and 100 guys break into a church coming in through all the windows.
Which happens to me on a daily basis.
You don't, if you're Chow Yun-Fat, you don't dodge behind a pew. You stand there, don't move at all, and you just casually turn and shoot everyone the moment
in slow motion with doves flying everywhere.
Well, no. It didn't get quite that heroic bloodshed. But that always cracks me up with this. Like, Chow Yun-Fat's too cool to hide from people. Like, bullets are coming at him and they go, oh, shit, no.
I feel like
they dodge past him.
When he inevitably passes on, that's going to be on his tombstone. Too cool to hide from people.
Seriously. He's great in this film. It's a terrific chance to see him doing the type of stuff we used to love him for doing. He hasn't done for a while, quite frankly. With a terrific film that does have a lot of Scorsese-esque touches to it. Mm-hmm. And just great filmmaking more often than not in it. Sammo Hung also plays a terrific role in this film as well. But yeah, highly recommend this one. Well worth a look for fans of Chow Yun-Fat.
Right on. Well, moving on from there, we're going to talk about Hidden in the Woods, which, if you ask me, is a film that should have stayed as such.
Why were people recommending this film?
It was the... Okay, I'll break down the basic story for you and see if you can figure out where it might get a little difficult to watch. So this is about a drug dealer who kills his wife at the beginning of the film and then raises his two daughters in this little tiny shack in the middle of the woods where he continues to sell drugs when he's not busy raping both of his daughters on a daily basis. Oh, and at one point, gets one of them pregnant and then gives birth to this inbred hill person that he then locks up in a different shack. And it's just like, that's the setup of the movie.
That's halfway through the first act, that's what we get.
That's what you're given to work with. It's like, okay, now enjoy the show. And it's like, fuck you. And it just continues to, if this movie had a single thing to say about anything, if it had done anything interesting that I could have been like, this is the kind of movie that I feel people, when they say things like Fantastic Fest is way too rapey, they assume every film is this. This is what's in their mind.
This is somebody, you know what this is? This is a Chilean film director who saw I Spit on Your Grave.
Oh, God,
and
yeah.
And said, I want to do something even worse than that.
Yeah.
What this is.
It has all the rancid earmarks of 70s rape revenge.
Yeah, and even worse, at least I Spit on Your Grave's gore was convincing enough looking. This is so badly filmed and so badly done gore. I mean, yeah, it's gory as hell, but never once does it seem like real gore at all. I mean, it's all like, well, you see, like, they literally just, like, somebody's eviscerated, so they just dump intestines on top of his chest.
Yeah.
And that's supposed to be it. That type of thing.
Yeah.
Like, very quick cut. Like, oh, someone's chewing human flesh. So let's kind of look at it kind of from the side so we don't get a really close look at it so you can't see that it doesn't look anything like what it's supposed
to be. And there are points where they go needlessly, like, slasher film with this. Like, at one point, the dad's arm gets broken and then he stabs someone with the protruding shard of bone. And I'm like, what kind of fucking movie did you think you were making?
You know, I thought this might get a little more interesting when the girls escape and they're on the run. They're, like, with their mutated brother and, like, oh, all right, we're going to make it away from our dad's and got caught. He's in prison. Now we can do whatever we want. The problem is the dad worked for a drug lord. He, for no reason that makes sense, wants to find the girls. Why would they know where the drugs were? He knew this guy was raping his own daughter.
Well, and not only that, but at the beginning of the movie, it seems really odd when he says it, the drug lord says to the drug dealer dad rapist, oh, you keep all your drugs in your house. I think that's very smart. And then later he's like, where are all the drugs? I'm like, I don't know. Did you maybe check the house where you know they are?
A question which is never resolved.
Not at all.
It's just abandoned.
I'm like, just completely. You know where the fucking drugs are. Go to the house where it's leave the kids alone.
You know, all right, and even with all that, I might have given this, like, something. Because I gotta admit, both the girls were really hot and get naked and stuff.
But that is a thing that happens in the film.
It does get happening here. Although it would help if they weren't having incestuous sex and being raped.
It's so just ugly. It's an ugly fucking movie.
When for no fucking reason the girls develop a taste for human flesh.
Yeah.
Literally no reason.
Yeah, it's that point where you realize, oh, the person who wrote this script really had no concept of what film they were trying to make and just made every film they could think of.
This is just garbage, pure and simple. Yeah. The only reason anybody would want to see this is if they want to see those, if they're laughing at it with a group of people who are also drunk in a mean-spirited way.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing to like here. It's just trying to be atrocious for atrocious sake and not even doing it well.
I believe this was released under the Artsploitation label, and they got half of that portmanteau correct. I will give you that.
How did this win festival awards?
That must have been a really shitty year for that festival. That's all I can think.
I don't even get it. I would like to point out that Fantastic Fest is not one of the festivals that
Boom.
This played at.
Take that.
Hopefully they knew that this was shit when they saw it.
Oh, well. We're going to move on quickly from that and talk about Bless Me, Ultima.
Now, this is a film that is a Spanish-speaking film, at least in parts, that is really worth your time, as opposed to that piece of shit. I'm sorry. It made me mad.
No, it made me mad that a company would look at that movie and go, oh, we should definitely release this. This yeah. is a thing we should put out so that people can see it.
Now, this movie, Bless Me, Ultima, is one of those things that people have been trying to make a movie out of this for decades. It came out in 1972, and it was it's listed as the most widely read and critically acclaimed novel in the Chicano literary canon since it first came out. It's taught in middle schools, high schools, and universities. It's adopted as a way to multiculturalize classes. It's about the Chicano culture of the 1940s in rural New Mexico, and it follows Antonio, who is a teen, just preteen, and it's kind of a coming-of-age story with his curandera, I'm probably saying that wrong, older woman who's kind of like a witch, if you will, witch doctor.
Okay, you know? A shaman.
Yeah, who has become his protector and his mentor.
Medicine woman.
Yeah, you know, how he's learning how to do this, and it has a lot to do with local corruption and crime and machismo. I mean, honestly, a lot of the pleasure of this is in the surprise and watching all the way this plays out. It's an incredible story. It really is. And it's one of those things, like, it's up to you to decide whether things that happen have a metaphysical edge or not. Maybe you look at it one way, there's nothing metaphysical going on. It's just the way people interpret things when they look at things a certain way. You look at it another way, it's this beautiful fairy tale. It reminded me of Pan's Labyrinth in that way.
Okay.
That it has that kind of angle going on to it. As we watch this kid going through just horrible shit starting to happen around him in his culture and lots of crime, the rise of crime lords and stuff, and him trying to stay true and noble in his own, in a kid's definition of that, and coming to terms with some of the darkness of the world around him. There's a lot of beauty here in these underlying messages and metaphors that are hidden throughout this thing. And I loved the performances so much here. I found, like, there's a point in this movie where you kind of get what they're doing, and it's that thing of, like, a kid sort of going, how much do I want to believe the world is a fairy tale, and how much do I want to believe it's, like, just reality and it is what it is? I mean, it deals specifically with agnosticism at points and the decision of whether or not you'll be happier to believe in the fantasy or not, and never really makes a decision one way or the other. It's a really interesting story. Now, the film, of course, is probably not as good of an adaptation of this as you could make. I mean, it's very low budget. Most of these actors I was largely unfamiliar with, but it's still pretty damn good, all things considered. It's one of those ones came out of nowhere. I wasn't even supposed to go to when I saw it in the theater, and I was like, I happen to be downtown anyway. I'll go see it.
One of those Violet Crown screenings?
Yeah. It really kind of blew me away. I got to say, I really recommend this. This is a cool film. You can watch this with your family, even as long as there's no one there who's flat out going to freak out if there's a tiny bit of blood. Because there is some violence in here, most definitely.
Okay.
But, yeah, really good. And based on, like I said, a really important book. So, well worth your time.
All right. Well, from there, we're going to talk about Slacker. Of course, this is Richard Linklater's seminal film that has just made its Criterion Blu-ray release.
I'm surprised it took this long.
Yeah, I am too.
This is such Criterion bait.
Yeah, Criterion bait.
Yeah.
Look, guys, as much as I love you, I'm sorry. Fantastic Fest is catching up with me, and I'm going to have to go to bed or start snoring right here.
Oh, come on. You know we love you.
Much though I love everyone involved.
We're losing Luke. Good night,
because
Luke.
Because I am a slacker.
We know, hey. You know we love you, pussy.
That'll do it, man.
Slacker came out in 1991, and I moved to Austin in 1992.
Okay.
I saw this about 6 months before I moved to Austin and went, Well, do I really want to move this town? And then I moved here and I met almost everyone who starred in this film. I haven't actually seen it since then. In fact, one of the main characters in here, as much as there is a main character, ended up being not only the first person I met in Austin, but one of the guys I knew the longest, who ended up being the head brewer for Live Oak Brewery here in town.
Okay.
And literally would not let me pay for beer.
Okay.
Like, would not. I'd come in and go, hey, man, can I buy a keg? He's like, no, but you can have one. There you go.
Shit. Yeah. Who are these people sadly, that you know?
Sadly, he moved away.
Aw.
By the way, if you're in town, drink Live Oak Brewery beer because they're fucking fantastic.
They're just a good beer in general.
They're really good beers there. Live Oak Liberation, one of the best IPAs I've ever had. But Richard Linklater, this was really his first feature film. And it's a... it's hard to really say what this is. It's very, like...
Like a slice of life film, maybe?
Not even, because slice of life focuses on a singular group of characters. Mm-hmm. This is like the film equivalent of free writing slice of life.
Ah.
Where it's like one day and it follows a character and then another character will come in and the camera will change its mind and start following that character around and see what they do for a while. And then someone else will enter their orbit and they'll go, oh, I'm going to go see what this guy is doing. And it's the way to describe this film is kind of like people have asked me, was Austin really like this in the early 90s? And I'm like, yes and no. It's one of those examples where it's more true than the actual truth, you know, because it wasn't like this. But at the same time, you know, it's
like a slight exaggeration.
It's a lie that resembles the truth more than the actual real story did. You know, it's a fantasized, exaggerated version of Austin filled with bohemians and conspiracy theorists and madmen. And I have met every single archetype in this film at one time or another in Austin in the 90s. And it is crazy. If you've seen, what's the animated weird psychedelic one that he did?
Scanner Darkly.
No, the other one before that.
Oh, Waking Life.
Waking Life.
Yeah.
Waking Life is a lesser version of Slacker in a lot of ways because at least you don't have the advantage of seeing like, hey, this is really a picture of a time because of the animation there. I didn't like Waking Life as much, but you can't help but compare them. They have that same sort of like, just move on from one thing to the other. Lots of crazy people talking about philosophy stuff. And it's hard. You gotta be well awake for it, but it's kind of hard to turn away from it at the same time. These are fascinating people. And a lot of them kind of based on themselves. You know, like the cover girl in here is Teresa Taylor, who shows up with a bottle of Madonna's pap smear that she got from a friend of hers in L.A. and is trying to sell it to some people on the street.
Okay.
She was actually one of the drummers for the Butthole Surfers.
Okay.
Yeah. A seriously weird chick, for the record. I've met her on a number of occasions. Lewis Black. From the Austin Chronicle here in town, one of the publishers of the Austin Chronicle.
Yeah, not the stand-up comedian, but...
No, not the stand-up comedian. Richard Linklater plays the initial character we see in here. If you've ever been to Austin, there's a band called the Asylum Street Spankers that was here for a long time, and really famous band who do sort of like 20s-style comedy music routine stuff. Really famous. And the lead guy from that, Wham-O, has a big role in here. It's a portrait of a time in Austin and one that's accurate in a mythological way almost. And it is a good film, but only for those who are in the mood to deal with this sort of narrativeless madness.
Sure.
Now this is Criterion and they've released this before on DVD. This is the first Blu-ray release of this. So there's a lot of bonus features. It adds on all the stuff that we got on the Blu-ray and puts a lot of shit on top of that. There's a thing with a lot of the original script for Slackers, as much as there was a script,
which yeah.
It's actually really interesting. The book that comes with this is huge and has his mission statement that he gave to all his actors.
Oh, wow.
This is what we're trying to achieve. And it's kind of metaphysical and really incredible concept in making a movie once you read it out there in front of you. It's incredible this got made at all. Quite frankly, looking at that. But there's lots of stuff original cast interviews of these people. There's a collection of 13 deleted scenes and alternate takes. The original trailer, A 2001 reunion, 10-year anniversary screening of Slacker that they got everybody back together and they're talking to them after all that fact. A trailer called for a movie I've seen called Viva Les Amis. There was this wonderful restaurant on the drag that's featured here in the movie several times called Les Amis. It was a sort of a bohemian hipster hangout back at that point. That was a terrific place. It's no longer there, but, you know, it's a look at that documentary from it. A lot of other people I know in that documentary as well. Their early short films by Linkletter, never shown anywhere else before. Audio commentaries.
Wow.
This is like, if you live in Austin or you love Austin or you want to move to Austin, this is kind of an essential release. If you're a film fan who just likes to be told a story, you're probably going to want to skip this.
This
one
may not be for
this
you.
This is not for you.
Well, moving on from Slacker, we're going to talk about The Devil Bat, which is a Kino release from 1940. Thank you. I had it in front of me and then it disappeared.
I didn't get a chance to watch this yet, unfortunately.
Okay.
And it has Bela Lugosi prominently on the title. And I assumed this was just a horror film, but I didn't realize this is a comedy horror movie.
I don't know if it doesn't feel like it was supposed to be. I mean, yeah, it was hilarious to behold.
I mean, it's Wikipedia listed as a comedy horror, so I guess it was intentionally trying to be goofy.
Man, I feel like that's sort of a stretch, because I feel like most of the movie is played as a straight-up monster movie that is trying to capitalize on the universal monster trend, and it is nigh unwatchable into that regard, because it's literally one of those things where Bela Lugosi plays a mad scientist who is using electricity to somehow make bats grow to enormous sizes. I don't know. And then he sends these... What he does is he gives people, like, this cologne, this aftershave, and it's like, oh, you should try this. This is what I'm working on. He'll always talk like a vampire in my head.
Of course.
This is what I'm working on. It's like, oh, this smells weird, but okay.
Pull
the strings! It's like, okay, well, this smells weird, but thanks for giving it to me. And then, wouldn't you know it, that attracts the devil bat, and he sends it out to kill people. And then there's this detective and a journalist and a photographer who are sent in to solve the case for some reason. And it just, I mean, it's goofy and it's silly, but it's no more goofy or silly than any of the stuff that was just flawed about certain monster movies of the 40s and 50s, to the point that I never recognized it as trying to be funny,
yeah.
Even though there were a couple points where I just laughed. Like, for example, they have no idea what a bat sounds like in this movie. Like, the bat will fly in and go, and it's like, what the fuck is that supposed to be?
They didn't have the internet then.
Or actual bats to look at, to listen to.
There's probably lots of areas of the world that don't have bats. Just say it.
Well,
obviously, if they had gone and watched Slacker, they'd know what bats sound.
Well, there you go. And there's a case to be made that they didn't, because every time Bela Lugosi interacts with a bat, it's like him profile, like, yes, my lovely, and then stock footage of a bat. And it's like, yes, I know. And it's like this weird conversation between a profile Bela Lugosi and clearly stock footage of a bat.
The bat's like, what's going on, man?
I'm not even in this scene. I don't know who's talking to me. But
don't
yeah.
talk, bat. We'd have to pay you more than scale.
It's a really silly movie. This is one of those, if you want sort of the example of the lesser Bela Lugosi films, the Bela Lugosi films that sort of epitomize his later Ed Wood type days, this is one of, like, and this isn't even that far into his career, but it's sort of a sign of things to come. And I don't know. I think there is definitely a market. I mean, I have friends who are die-hard classic monster and Bela Lugosi fans, and they'll probably get a kick out of owning this. It didn't do anything for me, and it's not a good-looking Blu-ray. I mean, they probably had, like, dirt-poor elements that they had to dig out of the ground, so I don't necessarily blame Kino, but it really looks shitty. Wow. Like, to the point that there's artifacts moving around on the film. Like, and I'm not talking small, I'm talking, like, fingerprints, like, that will move around the scene, because it's just, that was on the element, and they didn't have the money to take it off. So I don't know. I think this release is going to be for diehard Bela Lugosi fans only. Otherwise, you're going to want to skip it.
Fair enough.
All right. From Devil Bat, we're going to talk about Disconnect. And I thought about doing a joke where I was like, we're going to talk about Disconnect and then pretend that our podcast got disconnected.
I'm kind of glad you didn't.
But then it would be a nightmare to edit. It'd be like, what happened to the rest of the show?
Disconnect is one of those films. I don't think they even showed this in Austin, which surprises me because it actually got pretty damn good reviews from festivals and stuff that it played at and in the cities that it did get a showing for. But it's an odd little, they call it a thriller. I guess it is, technically. The closest thing this resembles is Magnolia, quite frankly.
Oh, okay.
By, what's his name?
P.T. Anderson.
P.T. Anderson, in terms of its structure. Or I guess you could say Crash, you know, in that same sense that it's like all these different people and their stories and the way that the film gradually it becomes clear that they're all connected to some degree. But it's not really about the fact they're connected. That's just the film structure that it has to make it an interesting story. It's the theme is the most important thing. And here the theme is really about how the false intimacy of social networking and the ways we communicate with each other through cell phones and everything like that. I mean, that's the central theme. And it doesn't hit you over the head with any, like, this is bad. It's just, it's talking about the real thing that, like, yeah, there is a false intimacy. It has characters who get themselves in all sorts of not cool situations because of this. Jason Bateman is in here playing one of the only dramatic roles I've ever seen him play. And he really, like, it comes to a real dramatic, amazing crisis point for his character towards the end that you're like, okay, he's got it in him. If you ever had doubt he could play a more serious role in a film, this should take all that away from you. He's terrific here. His character has a son who's kind of, you know, he's the kid who in today's world listens to Joy Division, has hair that hangs in his face and no one wants to talk to him in high school. And some kids who go to his school decide to start fucking with him on the internet, find a Facebook page, create a fake Facebook page for a cute girl and start communicating on him saying, hey, I really like the songs you posted on your page because the kid's a musician. It's like, let's talk more, start kind of, you know, seducing him. Get him to post a naked picture of himself and then show it to the entire high school.
Jesus.
Which, of course, leads the kid to try and commit suicide. The father, Jason Bateman, is determined to find out who did this no matter what. Go to the other side of this. We've got the father of these kids. I believe it's Frank Grillo, I believe, is the actor who plays, Frank Grillo, who plays the dad of that kid, who's a cop, ex-cop. Now he deals with internet crime because that's what he worked with when on the police force, like computer crime type stuff. So he works privately dealing with those sort of cases, and he doesn't have any idea what his son is doing in his own life, has no clue. He's working for Paula Patton, who had son died or child died long ago, a couple years ago, and she and her husband have become distant with each other, and her only real connection is on the internet with a guy she doesn't really know who it is, but a guy who they just have sympathetic talks with each other about both having lost a child before, or I believe he lost his wife. When suddenly it turns out that their whole system has been hacked and they've lost all their money, this computer crime expert says, well, the most likely person, as near as I can tell, is this guy, and they decide to take action on their own and go find him and start fucking with them. As well, you have a story with Max Thiroux, who is one of those, you know those, okay, you've looked at porn.
Yeah.
On the internet.
Almost exclusively.
And you know how you get those pop-ups whenever you bring up a porn page you want to see that has like a live video of somebody in a room going, hey, do you want to chat with me privately?
Oh, like it's totally trying to make you think that person's actually talking to you?
Well, that's the thing, though, is that those sites really do exist. There are people who make their whole living off being those things, and you can just watch them and write chat stuff, but they make their money for free. But they make their money by convincing people to pay for a private chat room with them.
Weird.
And then they'll do whatever you ask them to. Hey, you want me to see put a dildo on my ass? What do you want to see? Max Thoreau plays one of those, a guy who does it.
Okay.
And the thing is, this reporter comes across this and discovers, he basically starts talking to him, getting to know him through this, and talks him into letting him do an anonymous story that she can report on the news about these sort of things. Because he's like, oh yeah, there's kids, the guy who runs this, he's a great guy. He takes good care of us. We love him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, part of what I got to do is go to the mall and try and find like 15-year-old runaway kids and bring them in to do this.
Weird.
So it is child pornography. No question.
No question.
But it's weird because the guy who runs it is not really a dick. He's just like, other than the fact he's doing child pornography, he's like, he takes good care of all these kids.
I was going to say, could be made.
And the guy's like, I like what I do for a living. I don't know what to tell you. But the reporter wants it to be like, wants a different story from it and is willing to do ultimately whatever it takes in manipulation through this, creating her own false identity of who she is, using this sort of electronic manipulation to sell him on the idea of turning, you know, evidence on this. The problem is when the FBI get involved and say, I don't care if you're a reporter or not, you're going to fucking tell us who these people are. Or we're going to take you to jail.
Yeah.
Oops. So there's a lot of different stories that come together as we find out all these people have a connection of one kind or another. Nothing's really as it appears, but only in a sense of how people's emotions work in the real world as opposed to how we decide they work based on what we know about them online. And it's fascinating in that way, and it's very well filmed. It's perhaps not quite as good a film as it wants to be. You know, it's not quite as important as it wants to be, but it's still pretty damn good, and it presents lots of great performances. Like I said, Jason Bateman in this is so good. He's just terrific. Max Thoreau as well turns in a terrific performance. This is well worth your time. If you like Magnolia, you should watch this. It's not as good as Magnolia, but it's still pretty damn good.
Fair enough. All right. Well, this next one I'm actually really excited to talk about because this Blu-ray from Magnolia, see that? See?
Oh, see, that's, full connection
see
there.
See that? How that's a segue? Is the first time I've been able to see this film, and that is VHS 2.
So mad they didn't send this to me.
They may have. It just came today.
I looked in the mailbox. It wasn't there.
Oh, that's too bad. So yeah, I think it's pretty well documented that Chris and I are fans of the first VHS. Which,
oh, no, I'm not.
What, were you not?
No.
Oh.
No, I only liked the last story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the first story was, not the wraparound of the story, wraparound story was awful. The first story was okay. It was cool, went on too long, and I liked the effects in it. The last story was fantastic and should have just been the movie they spent their money on. The rest of it I thought was kind of shit.
Wow, my memory is going, because I saw it with you at Fantastic Fest and I could have sworn that you, anyway.
No, I really, in fact, we even had kind of an argument about it at the time.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah.
But neither here nor there. This is, I mean, VHS, what it was is it was combining two subgenres of horror, which was the found footage as well as the anthology. So each vignette within the anthology was a found footage film. And they've brought that back again with this one. And sort of the appeal for a lot of us was that the first one brought together a lot of the young up and coming guys in horror. Ty West, yeah. You know, Adam Wingard, Simon Barrett, who did Your Next.
A great conceit to get this new, you know, the new mavericks of horror all together, a chance to do whatever. Do something experimental. Try something different.
And definitely the group that they put together here for the sequel is, again, really impressive. Adam Wingard and Simon Barrett came back because, you know, that's just what they do. But Jason Eisner, who did Hobo with a Shotgun, is here. Gareth Evans, who did The Raid, is here. Eduardo Sanchez, who did Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
And unsurprisingly, his segment takes place in the woods. And then basically the wraparound story is that it's a very similar house. Like there's that old creepy house, like very similar to the one in the first one. I don't think it's the same house because it looks a little bit different, but the way it's set up with like all the TVs that are just on and, you know, the tapes that you put in and what that does to the people that watch them. And then each tape is its own little found footage horror film. I definitely think my favorite of the bunch was Gareth Evans, which takes place in this sort of, Indonesian compound where this cult leader is sort of, he's very, like, he's locally around town, he's known as just sort of an eccentric guy, but he has all these people living on a compound and, you know, they just kind of hang on what he says. So this documentary film crew decides, hey, can we come in and just kind of get your side of the story? And he's like, yeah. And shit goes insanely bad. Like, I loved it. I loved everything about it. I was like, when shit really starts hitting the fan, it's one of those perfect moments where you don't even care anymore about why wouldn't you just put the camera down and run. It doesn't fucking matter anymore. And plus, they also build into it that this compound has security cameras, so you're getting angles more than just, you know, the person holding
right,
it.
Right, right.
And then Slumber Party Alien Abduction, which is a very demonstrative title, to say the least, is Jason Eisner's. And that was really intense because even though he's using sort of the basic grays, you know what I mean when I say the grays? Like
the Close Encounters of the Third Kind aliens.
Exactly. I mean, they're very standard-looking aliens, but the way that he films them and the way they come at you, it's just like, oh no, this is not cool. I am not cool with this at all. I do not want this Close Encounter.
Turns out they're all just a cult of Kate Moss fanatics.
And then you have A Ride in a Park, which is Eduardo Sanchez, and it tells a horror story that we've seen several times, but from a different perspective, and that's all I'm going to say about that. So I feel like this one, honestly, I liked a lot more than the first one. And I liked the first one. Mm-hmm. But I felt like this one had a uniformity of strength to the individual vignettes. Because
they felt lay more tied together?
They felt stronger, each one of them individually.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
And you know, with any anthology horror film, there's going to be ones you just don't like. I mean, that's just kind of the way it is. And especially when you're working with this many different types of filmmakers. And that's not to say they're all great, but they were all really strong. Whereas even I, who liked the first VHS, recognized that there were a couple that's just like, okay, like the one of the two people on vacation. I was just like, okay, this is dumb.
So there's, you know, the first one had a bookending narrative. And I see this does too.
Yes.
Does this relate in any way to the bookending narrative of the first one?
Only in so much as it deals with the similar concept that the more you watch these tapes, the more it starts to affect you.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's not the same. The wraparound story is about a detective who's hired to find this woman's son, who he tracks to this house, and then he's watching these tapes and sort of gets an idea what happened to him, and by the time he figures it out, it's like, oh, but there's something bad in this house, and I'm in here with it. So, I mean, like I said, I think what is really great about VHS 2 is that it strengthens each individual vignette so that the overall product is actually stronger than it was in the first one. So I really, really recommend if you were a fan of the first one, I think that you're going to like this more. If you weren't a fan of the first one, give this a shot. You're obviously going to like this more.
You know, the one thing I'll say I was sad to hear with this is that the group that did my favorite part of the original Radio Silence is not connected with this in any way.
Well, and most of them are. Like, most of the filmmakers who were a part of the first one didn't come back for this one. Simon and Adam, I think they couldn't get rid of them. Like, I think they were just gonna stay and that's...
Well, yeah, it wasn't, weren't they, no, I guess they weren't involved in the production, so, never mind. my mistake.
But definitely give this a shot. VHS 2, good stuff.
Cool.
Alright, well that was actually our last title, but we still have to do our giveaway! And since we are in the middle of Fantastic Fest, we don't have a new item to give away, but we do have something from Digital Noise Past.
So instead, we're going to give you my old shoe.
There you go. Congratulations. You've won Chris's old shoe.
It has my DNA in it, which you could clone and make your own Chris.
There's a lot of things around your house that I fear have your DNA on it. but no, this is from the past of a couple weeks ago, and it is The Twilight Zone Season 5 on DVD,
yep.
Which, if you listen to Chris's review, is regarded as a weaker season, but has some of the best episodes in Twilight Zone canon. Yeah,
it's like being the least good-looking chick at the best Miss America pageant. You know? You're like, okay, it's still pretty fucking good-looking.
You're still gorgeous. Plus, we're not going to nitpick about you because that was great. I don't know if you followed any of that shit that happened with Miss America this year.
I did.
It's fucking disgusting, man.
All I know is that George Takei had her on his show and went, wow, she's a Star Trek geek. And I was like, that's all I need to know.
Yeah, yeah. And she's gorgeous, but because it's the internet, people feel like they're entitled to be like, well, she's not as gorgeous as the other, so she's ugly and bleh.
She's not from America because her genetic heritage is from a different country. You aren't clear on how this whole America thing works, are you?
I love our corner of the internet. You guys who listen to us and support us, you are the best. But in toto, fuck the internet. And I mean that.
Yeah. In toto, I'm glad we're not in Kansas anymore.
Or in Africa. because I bless the rains down in Africa. Apparently we're making
Thank
Toto.
Thank you for doing that. They need more rain down there.
So Twilight Zone Season 5 on DVD is still what we're giving away. And as you know, we've moved away from the fastest finger, who can spot what quickest type of giveaway. And we've done something a little bit more creative where we give you a prompt, something to write, and you give us your response, and then we pick our favorite. And, you know, I wasn't really sure what to do with this one this week. I've got it. Okay.
Go for it. I want to hear this.
I want you to write a Twilight Zone twist. Like, give us the very, like, basics of the setup, but really just give us what is revealed in the last few moments. You know, I'm talking about something like, oh, look, all the bomb has dropped, and I can read all these books. I finally have time, but I've broken my glasses. That's from an actual episode, so don't use that one. But yeah, do something fun and weird and interesting with the twist, or just go completely Gonzo M. Night Shyamalan with it. I don't care. Just write us something you think would be a fitting Twilight Zone twist ending.
And bonus points if you can tie it into either anything to do with oneofus.net or even one of the titles we talked about this week.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely bonus points for that. But that is going to bring us to the end of the show. So sad.
I'm sad. Now I can finally sleep.
Yeah, seriously.
Like Luke already has gone and done.
I was... If he hadn't done that, I may have backed out myself, been like, well, Luke can handle this. I'm just going to go to bed.
I'm totally lying. I have like another hour and a half of work to do before I go to bed.
My eyes are bleeding. anyway.
You know, it's funny how like even though we're both totally tired, in the middle of Fantastic Fest, like exhausted, a little drunk, I still have so much fun every time
we get
started. I'm like, oh, I got my energy back.
It's such a masochistic relationship with this festival because it does beat us down something awful. But the whole time we're like, yes, more. This is amazing.
But yes, Twilight Zone Season 5, you know what to do to win that. We'll pick favorite. We'll let you know. Want to remind you once again, you can find all of our stuff on iTunes. Just search One of Us in the podcast section. I want to remind you to go ahead and buy our purchasable commentary that we put out last week, which is Buckaroo Banzai, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, where Chris and I did a commentary with the great Mr. Johnny Neal.
I'm kind of proud of that one. I thought it turned out fantastic.
It did, and it's for sale at only $1.99. It's a bargain at any price, except that I just told you the price, and it's $1.99. So what are you waiting for? Go buy it.
And keep in mind, like, you buying that will help us keep the lights on here at oneofus.net. We really appreciate it.
And you're getting something for it. You're getting a commentary that you can keep, and every time you watch Buckaroo Banzai, you can have that to enjoy and feel like you're watching that movie right along with us.
And every time we record Digital Noise, we're giving shit right back to you.
Yeah.
With lots of prizes, and we're going to keep it every week. We're always going to have prizes.
We've never missed a week.
Never missed a week. Never not had a prize that I can remember.
Nope. As soon as we started giving stuff away, we just kept right on doing it. So, and we will continue doing that because you guys are great. Thank you for your support. You can follow us on Twitter. This show is at DigiNoiseCast. That's at D-I-G-I NoiseCast, all one word. I am at BryGuy Salisbury, and Chris, you are...
at Chris Cox Critic.
And the absentee Luke Mullen is at LD Mullen, not at Sleepy Face McGee or Dozy McDozerson.
At Brian's Gay Beard.
Fine. I'm okay with that. Luke is a very tender gentleman. I'm perfectly fine with that.
You guys are so cute when you're cuddled up together.
Hetero life mates. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Digital Noise. Thanks everybody for listening. I'm sorry if we came off a little bit loopy, but we are, like I said, smack dab in the middle of Fantastic Fest. We'll be back next week with a new show, new titles,
loopy. I thought you said a little bit lukey.
We're a little bit lukey.
I was like, no, Luke was lukey.
Our voices got baritone. We passed out. We had very, adamant opinions about letterboxing and
things happen.
Shadow boxing. I don't even know what
there's
I'm fucking saying
anymore.
There's
some things that I will disavow if you ever said that I said them. I don't care if they are on tape. It was obviously Photoshopped or whatever the audio equivalent of that is.
Whatever that is. But thanks for listening, everybody. And until next week, remember, fuck it. I'm going to sleep.